today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Is it time for the 1% to have a reckoning? Thanks to Senator Warren, we can now find out the CEO-to-employee pay ratio for publicly traded companies. Will this foment workplace revolution, company boycotts, or do you not care if the masters of the universe are making millions if you're doing well, too? We'll open the lines and ask. Then GBH's executive arts editor joins us for a roundup of the arts and culture events in and around town.
At noon, we'll ask national security expert Juliet Kim if the North Korea-U.S. summit was too good to be true now that Kim Jong-un is threatening to call the whole thing off. From national security, we move on to national obsession. Harriet Cross, the British Consul General to New England, is here to talk, I can't wait, about the royal wedding and why Americans are fixated. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live today. It's Wednesday, by the way, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
That is all correct.
Hello.
How are you?
Hello. I'm great.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Jim, too. There's
this New Yorker cartoon of a board meeting, and the big kahuna at the head of the table says, quote, "Let's never forget the public's desire for transparency has to be balanced by our need for concealment." Well, Senator Elizabeth Warren may have just cornered the folks in that corner office. Thanks to this SEC requirement, it came out of Dodd-Frank, I think, publicly traded companies have to disclose how their CEOs are paid compared to their employees. So could this mean a reckoning for the 1% now that employees at Walmart, just take one example, know their CEO to employee median pay ratio is 1,888 to 1, or down the street, by the way, at the Needham headquarters of TripAdvisor. What is TripAdvisor? 481 to 1. Now that they have that information, could this mean a workplace uprising? Does this give us consumers a reason to do our business where the distribution of wealth is more fair? Like at Dunkin' Donuts, for example.
Right.
We're just talking to Corby about it, where the CEO to employee pay ratio is only 48 to 1. But if you're making a decent wage, is it okay with you that your boss makes whatever he or she makes? 877-301-8970. This, by the way, the initial, we should say, it was Shirley Young who gave us
front
the thought.
Page of the Globe.
And, you know, by the way,
another great column
while we're
by
not
her.
Going to spend time on this, one of the interesting things is some of these companies like Vertex. Do you see what the median income at Vertex? Not for executives.
Yeah, they do well. Yeah,
but
median,
for their employees.
211 grand. But
one of the highest in the country.
It is one of the highest in the country. But they say in the story that they have to have a lot of...
well, they're research people. They're
they have to have a lot of
people,
excessive,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Not excessive degrees, extra advanced degrees,
yeah,
and stuff
it.
Like that.
It.
But here's the thing.
What is it?
That, you know, we talk about income and inequality now all the time. Mm-hmm. It didn't used to be this way.
No, it didn't.
This report that we saw this morning, CEO to worker pay has ballooned 1,000% since 1950.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone. The ratio has gone from, now it's up to, what is the average now?
250 or something.
Something like
I think,
that. Okay.
One, yeah.
Okay. So since 1950, it's gone up 1,000%. In 2000, the ratio was 120 to 1.
How about 1980? It was only 42 to 1. Only 42
yeah,
to 1.
Yeah, exactly. And it keeps going. It keeps going up and up and up. And this impacts the line workers' ability to pay their bills, obviously, and it also hurts GDP. It's not a good thing.
Well,
for
the reason it affects GDP for those, there's a lot of research that suggests the productivity of the people who work in a place
yep.
is lower where the ratio between CEO pay and median income of the workers there is higher. It's in great part because morale. I mean, it's pretty hard when you're working like a dog and your employer at Walmart makes almost 2,000 times as much as you do, or a TripAdvisor. Again, this is right. Their national or international headquarters is like, what, 10 miles from here? You see
yep.
it on 120. I think it's on 128 or, yeah, 128, I think it is. 400, what is it in Charlotte? 481 times as much for this guy, Stephen Kaufer. Now, the flip side is the question I asked at the end. The ratios are out of control, and it speaks to the
greed.
Well, not just the inequality thing is out of control and affects
here's
everything.
The thing, here's the line.
However,
what?
If wages were growing, at the same kind of rate that CEO pay was growing. Exactly. They're flat, essentially, since the recovery in mid-2009 officially began. So they're not at all.
This piece, I think it's from Bloomberg, says, when CEOs switch from asking the question of how much is enough to how much can I get, then everything kind of changed. Investor capital and executive talent started scrappling like hyenas for every single morsel, says this academic from the University of Toronto. But they talk also about how now a lot of these super executives with the super pay, they're looking at short-term performance, they're looking at maintaining dividends, share buybacks, quarterly earnings. It's not about the workers at all. So it's a great...
Well, obviously it's not about the workers at all if you're making 2,000 times as much. But it's also a status thing. You know, my CEO is bigger than your CEO, you know, in terms
That's
of
right.
salary kind of
That's
thing.
That's right.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I have to say, I've always been concerned about this, and I obviously the concern about inequality is far wider spread since the Occupy movement, since the Warren rising, and obviously the Bernie Sanders ascendancy during the last presidential campaign. But I'll tell you, this would be a lot less of an issue. I'm not saying it shouldn't be an issue. If wages were growing at a reasonable rate, you know, they're celebrating unemployment. Is it an 18-year low? And all those sort of things. But it's a real problem when wages are virtually stagnant and CEOs in some – I mean, this is – I'm sorry, because it's local. 400 – Stephen Cowper –
You mentioned TJX?
No, I didn't. What's this TJX thing?
Okay, hold on for a second. Where's the story?
Well, obviously, you shouldn't mention it either.
TJX. The average line worker is $11,243. Now, in fairness...
Wait, 11,000 what?
$11,243. Now, in fairness...
Dollars?
Yes.
An annual salary.
Now, in fairness to them, some of those people are working part-time. They're not working full-time.
Okay.
But the ratio there, where is TJX? Oh, my goodness, Jim, I can't find it.
If you guys can just go out and get a cup of coffee, Marjorie will find what she's looking for.
It's huge. It is absolutely huge.
Well, don't you remember when a year ago
we
talked about this, and it was roughly 2001, when the woman whose name escapes me was the CEO. She no longer is. It was roughly 2001. So does this bother you, or is your sense all I care about is that I'm making enough? And if the CEOs are rolling in dough, so be it, as long as I'm being able to take care of my family.
Let me say it one more time, that in the halcyon days,
post-war,
when your father could be a salesman and send two kids to college and the wife could afford to stay home if she wanted to and take care of the children, you could have a college education and all that, the executive to line worker ratio then, the CEO to line worker then, 20 to 1. Then in 1980, it was 42 to 1. Then in 2000, it was 120 to 1, and now we're up to 250 to 1. So once again, you know, it really cracks me up what a bunch of suckers we are in the United States of America.
Are?
You know, yes, we absolutely are. Our number's 877-301-8970. Do we just keep taking this?
We do.
Or do we?
I think you should.
Is there any way
too aggravating,
to kind of
bad for your blood pressure? It's not good on any front.
Fight
to
back,
about this.
And you also say, you know, what do you do with $20 million a year?
You know what I mean? I used to talk about these kinds of things when I was in the tax reform business. You used to ridicule me in that little column of yours in the Boston Herald, and then all of a sudden, you had an epiphany. What happened?
Because you were
trying, when they cut your health benefits when you left the Herald. That's what it was.
You were on the side of the pinky ring set.
No,
Jim.
I was not on the side of the. First of all, we don't call them a pinky ring set. I did get a decent amount of support from the leaders of some very important public employees.
Yeah, were you on the side of the state police? Were you working for the state police then?
I believe I was helping them with the phony overtime. Yes, I was on the side. 877-301-8970. Let's get this thing started. Stephen Charlestown, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was just going to say, Mark Twain once said, there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics.
Yes.
And I think this formula falls into that.
So
you've got Walmart, we'll say, where a huge amount of your workforce, maybe they're high school graduates, maybe they're not. That's a huge portion of their workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the biotech firm you just talked about, where their workforce, highly skilled, probably a lot of doctorates.
Mm-hmm.
You would expect the ratio between the CEO and the biotech firm to be very small, where you would expect the ratio of the CEO at Walmart versus his workforce to be very, very high. You're talking about very disparate
Okay, well, let's do this. Let's go out to TripAdvisor. And the CEO makes $48 million. I have no idea what he's doing out there for $48 million.
How much of that?
Excuse me, can I finish a sentence and then you can? He makes 481 times as much as the median salary at his workplace. And I'm sure you know, since you're lecturing us, median salary, half above, half below, which means he probably makes thousands of times more than his lower wage employees. So where is the lie in the statistics out of TripAdvisor, which is a locally headquartered company? Where's that lie?
How much of that was cash versus how much of that was perhaps stock appreciation rights that he cashed in, that he may have had for 10 or 15 years?
Yeah, so it's part of his income. It's calculated as income.
Steve, what I was trying to say before is this is overall. It's not just looking at places like Walmart where there might be a lot of part-time workers or TJX. It's looking overall at companies. And this is looked, and Bloomberg is reporting on this, and Forbes magazine is reporting on this. These are business publications which say that the ratio used to be a lot smaller at the time when the middle class in America was thriving. So it's overall. It's looking at all these companies.
It. So how about that, Steve?
I'm not going to disagree with that at all.
Okay.
And I remember back in, I think it was about 1980, a guy named David Mahoney got paid $1 million. First time a CEO went through $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And this was with a crummy conglomerate.
Yeah.
Very unprofitable. And since then, we've gone to huge pay. And I'm not going to defend the whole thing. What I'm saying is if you're looking at this ratio and you're trying to compare company to company to company, it's a very, very false ratio to be looking at.
Okay,
we got you, Steve.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
We thank you for your call. 877-301-8970. By the way, this data is pursuant to a law that Congress, which is fairly business-friendly, I think we can agree, passed. The Dodd-Frank bill requires this reporting, and it's the reporting from which this data is cold. Let's go to Dan in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for being here. Hi.
Hi, my pleasure. Just a reminder of the mantra that we hear all the time, which you have to offer these kinds of rates of compensation to attract qualified people. I mean, I love that. You have to offer massive salaries or massive compensation in order to attract the right people. I think that's what we're supposed to
Dan,
remember.
Dan, can I interrupt you before you continue? Because you just reminded me of one of my favorite stories along those lines. Before Cleve Killingsworth hightailed it out of town,
he was
the head of Blue Cross Blue Shield.
You always bring up poor Cleve Killingsworth.
Making about $10 million a year while his company was losing subscribers and losing money. There was an analysis done in the Tab newspapers, which were local newspapers, and it compared the constituency, the Blue Cross Blue Shield membership, to the number of people in the membership in MassHealth, which is, as I'm sure you know, the Medicaid program in Massachusetts, and the numbers were almost exactly the same. Killingsworth was making $10 million for a failing company. The guy who ran MassHealth with comparable constituency was making $120,000, which sort of totally undercuts the notion that you couldn't have found somebody as competent/incompetent as Cleve Killingsworth unless you paid him $10 million. So you were totally right, but continue.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's the basis of it. You're mentioning earlier about what's happening now with the tax breaks and the stock buybacks. It's something that happened when the quantitative easing was happening, and money could be gotten for very, very, very little or no interest. And these people basically had an opportunity to borrow a great deal of money, make huge stock buybacks, increase the amount of value for the shares without doing anything, and thus compensate themselves with stock options.
By the way, that's the report as to what many CEOs are doing with the tax cut that was just passed by Congress and signed by the president, when theoretically what was going to happen with that money that they saved is a huge reinvestment in their company or increases in their workers' salary. Dan, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
And this is another number, and you alluded to this before, but I'll just say it again. This is from the Economic Policy Institute, and they talk about overall, and with the understanding that some people may be working part-time, but overall in companies in the United States from 1978 to 2013, inflation-adjusted CEO compensation increased almost 1,000%, a rise more than double the stock market growth. Meanwhile, typical workers' compensation went up 10%. So 1,000% versus 10%.
Which is thousands more, right? math is, it's much more.
To be exact, 937% versus 10.2%.
Well, I can say I'd prefer the 937. I mean, I want to be upfront with you.
But you know what the thing is?
What's
that? We lionize these people. We don't.
No,
think
not
of
like
them
we used to.
As
some
greedy,
are socially
sleazy.
I don't agree with you.
People.
Some of them are socially responsible leaders that do a lot of wonderful
things
with their corporate money and their own money.
Yep.
Some are worried about self enrichment and nothing more. Those are I don't think the latter category are lionized like Lee Iacocca at Chrysler.
Remember
a few
years ago we talked about this, and I won't mention names because of your situation. You mentioned me before. But this is an executive in Boston who was being lionized by the business community in Boston. He was making many millions of dollars at the same time he was laying off thousands of people. You remember who I'm talking about.
I do. Well, by the way, if you recall, I had a ballot question in 1994 that was the first in the country. We won, and then it was repealed by the legislature, of course, in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That required every bank, publicly traded corporation, and insurance company to disclose what they paid in state taxes.
Right.
And we learned there that these companies that were paying virtually nothing were getting huge tax breaks from the state and exporting jobs beyond our borders. So that was 20 years ago, 24 years ago. This is not a new phenomenon. But again, there are some excellent CEOs that deserve serious compensation. I'm not sure they deserve hundreds of millions of dollars, and do wonderful things. And there are others who, frankly, are busy screwing their workers. And I'll tell you, despite that first call, which was a good one from the first gentleman called from Charlestown, I have to say, I don't care how you do the calculation. When the boss is making 2,000 times the wage of the median worker in his or her company, something's wrong with that picture.
You know, Paul makes a very good point about how people live in totally different universes.
Meaning what?
Well, once upon a time, and you looked at the Lowells or the Lawrences or my hometown, Fall River, the CEOs and employees typically lived in the same town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might have the big houses on the hills, and the people that work for them lived in the triple-deckers. But their neighbors, the ratio then was reasonable, and now we have this total segregation of people, where people that are making $17 million and $25 million and stuff, maybe they're living in one of those high rises in the Seaport or something, but generally they're living in places that are really, really expensive, while the people that they employ are having to, you know, drive an hour and a half on the Mass Pike to get to work.
So we should add a question before we take a break, because I think this is an important one. Marjorie gave you some statistics before. I think it was from 1980, the number, or not whatever number year it was, 1950. Would you prefer to see your salary go up 937% over that period of time, or 10%? Which, if you had a choice, because you want to stay humble. We all want to stay humble. But I would say most, not all people would say I'd take the 937%. We got to take a break, Marjorie.
Okay. We're talking about salaries. We're working off this Shirley Leung column on the front page of the Globe today and some information that Senator Warren was able to extract from Congress.
Well, public. It's public information.
It's public information. Well, what'd she have to do with it then?
Well, she's collecting it and putting it out there.
Okay, she's
available.
Collecting and putting it out there.
Yeah.
We're talking about CEO to pay ratio, asking you if it matters that it's huge for CEOs.
Yeah. Huge.
And not so much for everybody else.
Huge.
Listen to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about this a federal rule that requires publicly traded companies to disclose how much pay their executives get as compared, the ratio between their executives' pay and the median wage for their workers. We're taking your calls and asking what this means to you at 877-301-8970. If a company you work for, the ratio is something like 1,000 to 1, is that upsetting to you? Or if you say, well, I'm making a decent wage, I don't care what the CEO makes if I'm doing well. Consumers out there, would you consider boycotting a business where the executive-to-worker ratio is obscene, with the CEO making many, many millions while the worker is barely escaping poverty? You know, a lot of these social investment vehicles that, you know, don't put your money in climate-denying firms or climate-polluting firms, climate-disrupting firms, that sort of stuff, will not invest in certain companies where the ratio is higher than X. I don't know if it's 200 to 1 or whatever, because they consider it to be, I think it is, socially irresponsible policy.
Peter from Andover, thank you for calling.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. Nice to talk to you both. I love you both.
Thanks.
I would echo what I think it was Dan from Cambridge said.
Mm-hmm.
I think while sort of socially unjust, it's sort of the structure that we find ourselves in. And I hate to defend any CEO, but I think the risk they're taking is if they don't make the company perform the way their board expects, you know, that could have some big repercussions on their next potential career. You know, just like an NFL player is taking a risk of being injured and his career could be over. It seems to me a very high pressure, high risk job. And,
but what is that, Peter? I'm sorry. What does that explain? Assuming that your analysis is right, what does that state of affairs explain? The high CEO pay, the large differential in the ratio. What does it explain?
I think it explains all of it. I think it's just an exaggeration of the overall income inequality gap that we're seeing in this country. It's just a sort of an extreme example.
But see, Peter, it didn't always used to be this way. And that's what I find so surprising is that
saying corporate culture has changed, as that earlier caller
corporate
did.
Corporate culture has changed.
Well, it has, and that's reflected in these ratios. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
There was a time there was more regulation on capitalism. There was a time there was more regulation on banks.
There was more self-regulation, the feeling that you can't make 1,000 times what the median wage is for your workers.
Well,
it's just wrong.
You wouldn't be heralded and held up as a hero in your community if you were making millions of dollars and laying off 6,000 people, I wouldn't think. Although, we should point out that the guy that we always mentioned, he's
Malden Mills.
Yeah, Malden Mills, that kept his factory open when it burnt down. But that's a little bit different.
And kept paying. He didn't keep his factory open. He was closed. It was burnt down. He kept paying his people for quite a period of time.
And paying people. But in terms of the pressure on people, too, Mary just emailed, and she talks about a great point, and you talked about this with Cleve Killingsworth from Blue Cross.
What's that?
That in 2014, Forbes magazine reported on the fact that the more CEOs are paid, the worse the firm does over the next 3 years as far as stock performance and even accounting performance goes. And the other thing is that many of these CEOs get these enormous salaries even when the company is doing mm-hmm. horribly, and that was the point you were making about Cleve Killingsworth. So it doesn't necessarily seem to be based on performance. You may get fired, but you're going out the door, you know, with a... And now there are all these lawyers, too, that specialize in these golden parachutes. So you're going out the door with millions and millions and millions of dollars. And look at Roger...
Well, that's when Killingsworth escaped to upstate New York, wherever he went.
And Roger Ailes is a different situation because it was Fox News, but remember when
too.
He was... He is. But remember he was forced out after mm-hmm. all those women came forward? Mm-hmm. What did he get, a $40 million payout mm-hmm. or something like that?
Yeah,
anyway, Peter, thank you for the call.
He's got to feed his family. By the way, a lot of people... Aaron Feuerstein, obviously, is the guy from Malden Mills who we are talking about. It was a fire in the mid-90s. The plant with Polartec is what... Did they make Polartec? I think that was the case.
Yes.
And he made a decision to essentially keep paying these people rather than moving the company to the south or leaving these people on his own. You know what the horrible thing is? Is as much as I admired him, and I remember he was in the box, you know, once... I think it was Ronald Reagan started the thing where at the State of the Union you have some people who have done wonderful things based on your set of values in the box sitting next to the First Lady there. I'm quite sure Feuerstein was there during one of Bill Clinton's States of the Union. But how pathetic is it that a guy is internationally celebrated? I think he was on 60 Minutes. It was a huge international story because he decided, I can afford to keep my employees on the payroll since through no fault of their own, there is not a place to work now, and I don't want their families to suffer because they were loyal to my business and my family. I mean, the fact that that's such an outlier is rather incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is incredible. But as I said before, since from between 1978 and 2013...
Oh, I hadn't heard the statistic. What is it again?
Compensation for CEOs up almost 1,000%, while the average worker growth has been 10%.
And by the way, during the brief break, I want to update you. Marjorie and I had a little conference here. We both agree 937% is better than 10%. And by the way, even if you're not good at math, and I'm really good at math, Marjorie, so at math, that
I'm not very good at math.
The
math.
Exactly.
Math. Stefan in Worcester.
Hey,
hi.
Stefan, how are you?
Hi. How are you?
Excellent.
Good.
What's going on?
Good. So Bertolini left Aetna with $500 million.
Who?
So
who?
Head of Aetna.
Bertolini, the CEO, when CVS bought Aetna.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Aetna's an insurance company.
Yeah.
Okay? There's no risk in that. Any problems, any cost overruns are passed on to the people who buy Aetna.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, and his salary was a dollar. He took a lot more risk introducing an unknown product to a market than somebody who's just taking advantage of people who get cancer. Nobody chooses to get cancer. And that they should make enormous profits out of disease is evil. It's criminal. You know, there can be no accountability for someone who walks away with the money of a sick person who's going to die. It's a shame. And yet, we have soldiers who take enormous risks. They risk their lives. They don't get paid anything near what CEOs get paid.
Well, you know, soldiers in foreign lands and then teachers in our own land who are, is it North Carolina today where they had to close the schools because teachers can't afford to live there and on the salaries they make and educate the state's kids. So you're right. We do, our priorities are a little screwed up there. Stefan, thank you for your call.
Well, the other irony, and I hate to keep repeating myself.
Oh, please do.
Is that we, as the American taxpayers, subsidize a lot of these mm-hmm. corporations because the wages they pay are so low that people qualify for food stamps.
And but other federal benefits, Will, by the way, not just food stamps.
Will in Worcester. Hi, Will.
Hello, Will. Welcome.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Great show. Love you guys so much.
Thank you.
Really enjoy spending time with you every day.
Thank you.
Nice. Thanks.
I recently read a book by, I believe it's David Madland, and it's called Hollowed Out, and how this income disparity causes problems all the way down the line that even impact our trust in government and
our trust
in our fellow neighbors
mm-hmm.
because we no longer share the same, it's almost like parallel universes.
Yeah.
And it gets us to a place where we have Donald Trump. So it's far more than just they make more than me and they don't deserve it. It impacts how we view the world.
Well, you know, the only thing that John Edwards said that survived his fall from grace is there are two Americas. And there are two Americas. And you're right. There didn't, if you cite the statistics Marjorie was talking about from a couple of decades ago, there were not two Americas in the same sort of way. But you're right. There's a total separation and it has impact up and down the line. Will, thank you for your call. When did you get religion on this thing, Marjorie? When did you have an awakening? When was it? I mean, you weren't usually, economic populism was not your sort of...
Well, because you were defending some... It's a question of who's...
I wasn't defending anything.
Yes, you were. It depends.
A healthy public sector.
Yeah, a healthy public sector, but it depends on which part of the public sector you're talking
Maybe.
About. I'm all for getting higher wages and better benefits for social workers. I think the state police are paid just fine. I think there are a lot of teachers who are really shafted.
By the way, I had nothing to do with state. I
think there are other ones who are doing just fine. And and the reason I always fight with you about the teachers is because I think we need reforms. I don't hate teachers.
No.
I think the teachers that are out on strike in these states across the country are absolutely right because they are getting woefully underpaid. It's terrible. In Boston, that's not true. In Brooklyn, that's not true. In Cambridge, that's not true. The issue is the kids getting a better education, the schools staying open longer, and we can't seem to get those kind of reforms through.
Soon. We have time for one more quick call on this CEO to median worker pay ratio thing.
Lewis in Duxbury. Hi,
Lewis. Hi, Lewis. Welcome.
Hey there. Hi, Margaret and Jim.
Yep.
Reason I'm calling, I'm driving along just reflecting on the fact that it's really an indictment on capitalism, which is a system that is so perverted that it would allow this sort of remuneration. It reminds me of Michael Parenti's words when he said the rich are never satisfied, they want it all. if you know that and nothing else, you still know more than all those other people who know everything else, but not that. And thanks to you guys, we're just reminded that Karl Marx and Das Kapital, this is his 200th birthday, of course. Rolling over in his grave with a smile on his face.
So is Groucho Marx, by the way. They both are. They're both. Hey, thank you, Louis, for the call.
I don't think anybody's saying capitalism isn't the best system we found. I think it is the best system we found. You just have
but
to.
But it's out of control.
You have to regulate it more recently. I mean, I think we're undoing the regulations right now in Washington that may make what happened in 2007 happen again. But we are rather busy talking about other things, I guess, so we don't have time to pay attention
to that. Like the royal wedding. We won't get to that for an hour.
That's right, the royal wedding. That's coming up, and that's very important, Jim. Never underestimate the importance of a royal wedding. Anyway, coming up, Paddington gets a museum debut, and Star Trek's George Takei's musical Allegiance gets a New England premiere. Jim and I actually went and saw that.
I know. Is it amazing we actually saw something that Jared is reviewing?
Jared has seen it, too, and he's going to tell us all about it coming up. That and other culture happenings in and around town. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. In Ryan Landry's latest mashup, where Oklahoma meets Brokeback Mountain, the message is not so much go west, young man, go west, but go west, young man, and meet some others while you're there. Rhinestone cowboys, guns are blinging, tumbleweeds aren't the only things rolling around the dirt. And the Bald Eagles apparently get their due, too. Joining us for his take on this, George Takei's new musical Allegiance and other arts and culture events in and around town is GBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bone. Jared is also the host of a TV series Open Studio, and he's a coach, which is ridiculous. He's a judge on the great Sing That Thing. Hey there, Jared. Nice to see you.
What are you talking about? I'm a good coach.
No, I didn't say. No, you actually are an excellent coach, but the coach thing, as you know, gives me hives. But in any case, nice to see you.
Good to see you. We're having a little staff outing. Going to go see Brokelahomo, and I can't
Friday night we're all going.
Because it stars Ryan Landry. We have Ryan Landry in all the time, and he's unbelievably talented and unbelievably entertaining. So give us the review if there's any dramatic ending that we don't want to know about, leave that out. But give us a review of Brokelahomo. It sounds a riot.
Well, first of all, I am so jealous because you're all going, and I want to go just so that I can watch you guys watching this show. This is a really, really terrific show, and we've talked a lot about Ryan Landry's shows over the years in the Gold Dust Orphans, and I have to say, I think this is absolutely one of his best in years.
You do?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
There's just magic in this one, that everything comes together. It's hilarious. It's fun. As he seems to be doing more and more now, we find new young talent, which I think is staggering, that I see so many shows across town, and he's finding these people I've never seen before, and they just explode out with this great energy and magnetism. But Brokelahomo is a cross-section of a number of shows and a number of movies that we all know, from Destry Rides Again to,
Brokeback Mountain meets Oklahoma.
And so we're out on the prairie in this town that's managed by really a couple of women who have a monopoly over everything, and everybody there is gay, and they like it that way because they don't want the breeders to come in, otherwise known as straight people, to gentrify the neighborhood. But it's not quite well managed because you have the town drunk who's serving as the deputy. They do need some law and order, and law and order comes in the manner of Dusty Rhodes, this diminutive man who comes in, doesn't want to carry a gun, so there's some social commentary here. He's also prone to drinking milk and knitting sweaters. And so there's all sorts of murder, kidnapping, and Cher all out on the prairie.
You know, most people listening only know Ryan Landry, either because they've heard of the Gold Dust Orphans or from listening to our show. Describe his performance. I mean, he's the genius behind all this.
Yep.
Describe Ryan Landry as performer.
He's usually playing against type, so he's usually in drag. Uh-huh. And he's just somebody, he walks on stage, in that little stage in the Machine Club nightclub where you're all gathered together tightly against one another, and everybody is so excited to see him. He just draws that kind of energy, and that this is all springing out of his head. You know that you're seeing something fresh and original. And honestly, I really can't exaggerate this enough to say that if you've heard us talk about his shows over the year, and you thought, oh, I should go, but I haven't, this this is the one to see that would be a great introduction,
okay.
As you all will see when you go later
Friday
this week.
Friday night, the whole
there's
cast.
There's a great line in the Globe interview by Carolyn Clay, where she talks about, as you mentioned, the gun-smoking town full of lawless, feuding gay hombres sporting fringe chaps and color-coordinated holsters. The show serves up dancing bulls, coyotes and tutus, cowboy Muppets, and, as you said, an homage to Cher. So it sounds like it's going to be great.
I can't wait. I want texts from you all when you're seeing it. You said you're seeing it on Friday night.
Friday night.
I want texts from everyone.
Plus, can't you have cocktails during the show? Isn't
that part of the
deal?
Oh, yes,
you can.
You
can have them before, during and after.
Exactly. And you are, as Jared mentioned, you are at the Machine Club there. You are close to your neighbor, put it that way.
Yep.
It's a relatively packed, kind of fabulous venue.
And you have to wind through the bar to make your way downstairs. I think the whole experience is just
this,
part of the show.
And the thing is, till the 27th, am I right?
Through the 27th.
Then it's going to P-Town or something.
And that's going to P-Town. And then he announced from the stage that he's taking it to New York, too.
He is?
So really, this is your chance to see it here before it goes on to all these other places. So do it.
So Jim and I saw this performance in Allegiance, and it was really... moving, starring. It's inspired by the experiences of Star Trek actor George Takei. Tell people what it's about.
Well, Allegiance is a musical that was on Broadway, and he was actually in it. And it's now getting its Boston, New England premiere here by Speakeasy Stage Company, who's staging it through June 2nd. And as I said, George Takei was in it, but this is really inspired by his story. When he was about 5 years old, so from the age of 5 to 9, he spent time with his family in an internment camp during World War II. As we know, but a lot of people don't know this story, which is part of the reason that this show has been created. But a lot of Japanese Americans were rounded up after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and they were placed into an internment camp. The interesting thing about George Takei is because he was so young, and we talked to him on Open Studio this week, Jim, I know you guys had him here as well. He had fond memories of his time there because his parents really tried to shield him from the reality of what was happening. So he says he still has a great association with big band music from the 1940s and 50s, of course, from his time there. But obviously that wasn't the true reality of what was happening. Japanese Americans had their homes, their families, their incomes, their well-being taken away from them. They were put into these camps, and that's where we find Allegiance and this Kimura family who's been placed there, and the divisions that happen from one who wants to go off and fight because there was a loyalty questionnaire that they all had to take, to others who, of course, are just devastated by what has happened and they're angry. So we get this division that comes about in this show, and it's actually a musical. He was in town, of course, and when he was speaking with all of us, and this was the first time he was actually able to see the show.
Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that till the end of my TV interview with him, because he was in it in New York, and he hadn't seen the production here till they invited him to fly out for it.
It's such a strange thing. I never had that conception, actually, of an actor in a show.
I know.
Of course, they're backstage. They don't get to see the show ever.
By the way, that's a great venue. I am so into small venues where you can actually, you're almost on top of the performers. What's the name of the setting?
Speakeasy Stage Company, which performs at the Boston Center for the Arts in the back theater, which is the Roberts Theater. And yeah, it's a very intimate experience.
So a couple hundred people. It's great.
And I will tell you, I think this all gets distilled into what I thought was one great line from this show. One of the characters says, as they're in this camp, we're at war, meaning the U.S. is at war with Italy, but nobody put Joe DiMaggio in a camp. And yet they rounded up all of these Japanese Americans.
No, it was a great line, and he depicts kind of deprivation, where a little baby gets sick and can't get the care that is needed, and the food is terrible, and the accommodations are awful.
Abuse of prisoners, yeah.
Terrible abuse of prisoners. So it really gives you a very upsetting reminder of what... We did.
It does, but the flip side is, for those who are thinking this is this thing that is so painfully depressing at the end, I mean, it is really sad and really painful. There are also moments of joy and love in this camp. And, you know, the thing that stuck out for me when I talked to him, and I'm guessing with you too, Jared, when not only do so many Americans not really know much about this, if at all, which was part of his mission to put a human face on this unbelievable internment thing, the two principal players are two of the liberal icons in American history, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Earl Warren, who went on to become, then he was either the Attorney General or Governor of California, went on to become one of the most enlightened Chief Justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's pretty, it makes this even more perverse. By the way, we played this the other day. Here's a little bit of one of the songs in this a great score. It's Gaman, I think is how it's pronounced, which means perseverance or resilience or that sort of thing. Here's just a little piece of it. You know, it's also, by the way, the woman who, is it Grace Yu? I think it's her. She is otherworldly great.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She is getting back to the setting, just one more second, to see like a full-fledged Broadway musical, which is really what it is, in a small venue is so exciting beyond how great the thing itself was. It's great. And so, how long is this one there?
It's just there through June 2nd.
Yeah, if you get there, I mean, it's a great venue, great play, and I think you'll learn a lot. I learned a lot.
Well, you really do come away thinking about a lot, and this is something George Takei talked about as well. He learned about the notions of democracy from his father. So his father, who saw democracy completely thrown out mm-hmm. the window, instilled in his son the power of government and that it can return, and illustrated to his son, George, that, yes, you can see the worst of it, and government and democracy is very fallible, but at the same time, it can work when it does improve. And that's when he transitions into talking about Star Trek and how Gene Roddenberry really thought of it as this Starship Earth mm-hmm. and this utopian ideal of what people working together could be, people of all different kinds.
His father forgave also Roosevelt and his government for doing what he did to Japanese Americans. I'm talking to Jared Bowen about arts things going on in town.
Well, this is a little known, to say the least, play by Leonard Bernstein, Trouble in Tahiti. And I guess it's about his childhood, his parents, Sam and Jenny, who had a difficult marriage. And even when they got to the great big house in Newton, they moved from Mattapan, Dorchester. They got they were struggling. I think his father was an immigrant. They got to the beautiful home in Newton. They were still miserable.
Yeah, well, this is a pretty interesting biography by Leonard Bernstein in two different parts of his life. So this is being staged right now by Boston Lyric Opera through May 20th, and it's their entry into the Bernstein Centennial Celebrations. And so it's called Trouble in Tahiti and Arias and Barcaroles. And these are two different pieces. Trouble in Tahiti, which Leonard Bernstein wrote very early on in his career, 1952, while he was on his honeymoon, mind you. And the reason I'm sort of laughing is because this sets us down in 1950s suburbia, the white picket fence, literally the white picket fence, the White House, the flagstone driveway. There are references to Wellesley Hills, so you have the sense that Leonard Bernstein was definitely writing about growing up here in this very specific Massachusetts suburbia. And we find this couple, Sam and Dinah, and right from the first bars, the outset, we understand there are issues in this marriage. They're looking at each other with sort of this blaze. They're not happy. There are issues about questions about fidelity, children, money issues. And I think Boston Lyric Opera was very smart in how they staged it. So in the background, you have these projections of, we look back at all these wistful images of the 1950s and women perfectly coiffed in the dresses and the guys out happily mowing the lawn in their polo shirts. But of course, inside the house, this marriage is completely disintegrating. So they've coupled Trouble in Tahiti with Arias and Barcaroles, which is also about a couple. They got permission from the Bernstein estate to do this. And Bernstein was about... He wrote this 30 years later, so you may have a better sense at this point what kind of insight he had into his own marriage at this point that he can introduce this. But this all takes place at the DCR Sturridy Memorial Rink, as in ice rink, in the North End, and they've completely transformed it into this El Morocco-like supper club. And you can go in about 45 minutes early, enjoy the lounge, and then you walk into this really, really beautiful space. I haven't seen set design like this in Boston in a long time. So beautiful. You're sitting at these tables with the lamps, and you do feel like you're in the 1950s.
Why are we doing this at the ice rink?
Well, remember, Boston Lyric Opera doesn't have a home at the moment because they ended their agreement. They're no longer at the Schubert, so they have become kind of an itinerant arts organization. wandering around town performing at the Huntington Theater, now this ice rink, which is very, very smart. But this raises
one. Well, also, Bernstein was a legendary skater. Right. I'm sure you remember.
But it just seems like it's a big production to transform an ice rink into a theater as opposed to like going to a theater that's already there.
Well, it absolutely is. But this raises the issue, why doesn't our opera company, the major opera company in Boston, have a venue? Every other major city in the United States does. That's a question I think BLO would like answered. I think people at City Hall would like answered. Somebody has got to break here and come together with developers, especially as we're working at the waterfront development right now, and create an opera house for the city. We had one in the city until we tore it down in the early part of the 20th century.
By the way, very quickly on Bernstein before we move on, 100th anniversary, everybody knows, celebrated at GBH with some incredible things, the BSO. Keith Lockhart was here the other day.
Yes.
They're doing On the Town. They're doing West Side Story. I mean, if there was ever a year to focus on this genius who grew up here, this is the time and place. So speaking of theater, the Elliot Norton Awards, which are the Boston Theater Critics Awards, right?
Yep.
And you're a Boston Theater Critic.
Yep.
You're one of this.
Yep.
When is this, and what's the exciting part of this?
So this is happening May 21st. We spent all of, when I'm here, we spent a lot of time talking about Boston theater, and this is our annual version of the Tonys, the Elliot Norton Awards, named after the legendary theater critic who was very influential in the national theater landscape.
Didn't he work at the Herald at one?
He did.
Work at the Herald, and when he left, we were like vultures hovering around his typewriter.
Is that really true?
This is the olden days, yeah, because my typewriter had no period and no T, and I got his typewriter.
I typed for years
in the Elliot Norton typewriter.
My God.
Yeah,
Do you still have it?
No, we went computerized, and that was the end of that, but it was a thrill.
Some people save things like that.
You know what? I should have saved it.
You should have saved it. It would be a great piece of history.
But yeah. So when does this happen? The 21st?
So the awards are May 21st, and so all of the shows that we've talked about over the last year, you can see they're up for nominations. Huntington did very well this year with 15 nominations. Merrily We Roll Along, we talked about that on the show, did very well. Hype Man did very well.
So what, do you all get drunk and have a night? How do you do this?
Yeah, so it's just...
You didn't deny that, did you? How do you do this?
I don't get drunk. It's at the Huntington Theater Company. It's on stage. Randy Rainbow is our guest of honor this year.
He is a genius.
Tell people about Randy Rainbow who may not know. He's a riot.
He's hilarious, and he created these satires. He's a kid who grew up on musical theater and started doing these great parodies, and
online
just became,
you can get them all. They're brilliant.
It became a huge YouTube sensation. So I think he's performing at the Wilbur while he's here, but then he'll also be our guest of honor. Long line of guest of honors. We've got Tito Rivera, Tommy Tune, Al Pacino.
Tommy Tune.
We bring in hugely influential people every year.
It's a great night,
and there's a big party afterward, and everybody mingles, and it's a celebration of theater.
Another party we're not invited to, Marjorie. So
it's okay.
Now the Paddington Bear. Is having a... Is it a 60th anniversary celebration? Is that what it is?
It's the 60th anniversary.
And what's going on?
This just makes me so happy. I think we should spend 2 hours talking about Paddington. I think we all need a little Paddington Bear.
Yeah.
So, of course, he's the bear, the kind-hearted bear from deepest, darkest Peru. This is the 60th anniversary of when Michael Bond, who is a BBC cameraman, on his way home to his wife more than 60 years ago, spotted this little teddy bear on a shelf, kind of by itself, in a department store in London, and he bought it and he brought it home, and he and his wife began to speculate about how the bear came to be there, and thus Paddington Bear was born. And the story of Paddington is that he came from deepest, darkest Peru and was taken in by the Brown family. So essentially, Paddington Bear is a refugee, and Michael Bond was thinking that when he created it, because he was so stirred by images, newsreels he saw of kids being escorted out of Europe at World War
II. Is that the genesis of this?
Absolutely true, yeah. A part of it, yes. So right now, out at the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art in Amherst, it only takes about an hour and a half to go there, and it's beautiful. This time of year, they have the first ever exhibition of Paddington materials in America. So you see, speaking of typewriters, you see Michael Bond's original typewriter. You see the original sketches from his first illustrator, Peggy Fortnum, all the way up through R.W. Alley.
We had him here on the show.
He lives in Rhode Island, and he's illustrating Paddington now. And so you can immerse yourself. There are also other great first-hand materials, like a diagram that Michael Bond drew of the Brown family house, because R.W. Alley said, I'm a little bit confused about how Paddington moves from one room to the next. I can't conceptualize how the house exists. So he drew a diagram of the house and then the yard and then the next door neighbor's house. So you get all of these elements. It's nice to spend time with something that's nice and sweet and reminds you of the goodness on the
planet. Speaking of another really talented, is Eric Carle alive, by the way?
He is,
right?
Yeah. And this is his museum. He's still heavily involved with it.
That's great.
He's just about 90 years old.
He is fabulous.
Speaking of nice and sweet and goodness and light, I understand there's going to be a debut tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
Of Mandates.
What is Mandates on Greater Boston? What would that be? Instead of you promoting your self-serving stuff about your own show, why don't you do something that's collaborative here? What is Mandates?
I think Mandates refers to our date, Jim.
That is correct.
How we went on our very first date to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and had a very lovely dinner at the restaurant.
And great tour. Yeah. And we went in places in the museum where other people are not allowed to go. And
oh,
we
filmed really?
That. We're going to tell people that?
We did. They'll see it, actually. And this is the first in a series where Jared and I, Mandates, are going to go out around the city at different restaurants, museums, etc.
Is this the lovely museum that's kind of in a glass thing that they've...
The restaurant
part of the addition.
Is. Yep, yep.
Oh, that's a great spot.
I can tell you more about the restaurant because Jim spent most of his time in the restaurant just looking at me. So I can tell you about the environment.
By the way, how great was the food?
Was the food
if people
great?
Are into a nice combo, was it?
I'm still thinking.
Chef Pete was that? It was Pete, right? I mean, he was great. It was great. The place is fabulous. We had a great time. So tomorrow night on Greater
Boston.
You can
go there for lunch too.
The first edition or edition is that the right word? Mm-hmm. First edition of Mandates on.
It started with the burrata.
Greater Boston. Oh man,
that was just heavenly.
It was really
something. What's an open studio?
This week, sorry Jim, the only TV interview Alanis Morissette did for her
Jagged
Little Pill musical.
Oh gosh! Is
me
that really aggravates the hell out of me.
Was she neat?
How was she great?
She was fantastic.
She is
completely
fantastic.
Down to earth. And,
Jared, so we talk about great.
Yeah, we talk about Jagged Little Pill, which I have a deep connection to. It was when I was in college. It was the soundtrack of my time.
Yeah,
I mean, it was the voice of everybody. So it was great to talk to her. There's an American Repertory Theater musical that's about to, or it's playing now, actually, based on that album. So we talked about her music then and now. And then, so you see, Jim, this is where it evens out because you've already had him, but you'll see my interview with George Takei.
He's great.
Talking about Allegiance.
Can I tell you, he is one, I had never met, obviously never met him before. He was so solid and smart. I mean, the irony is we all know him of our generation, obviously, for this wonderful series, and the current generation knows him as this great human rights activist. He has 15 million
followers
on social media.
It's incredible.
Really,
and he's hilarious, too.
He is fabulous. He's really great. Jared, and when are you coaching again? Are you coaching again soon?
It'll be right before Open Studio, 8 o'clock, Friday night. Only two episodes left, I think.
Coach means judge, for those who don't speak the language.
Well, we are judging. I mean, let's be honest.
Exactly, they're judges.
Okay, Jared Bowen. Jared Bowen is WGBH's executive
arts
editor, host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30. And if you want a Jared Bowen double feature, tune in to Sing That Thing at 8 o'clock on Friday, where he is, as we just said, a coach. Thank you very much, Jared Bowen. Coming up. The United States Embassy in Jerusalem may be a victory for Trump, but not so for peace in the Middle East. National security expert Juliet Keim is here to go over that and other headlines. She is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And we are live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
At noon on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We're going back to the days of Little Rocket Man and the deranged dotard. First, North Korea cancels talks with Seoul. Now they're threatening to pull out of the upcoming summit over nuclear demands. If this meeting goes off the rails, will our standing on the international stage go with it? National security expert Juliet Keim joins us. From there, we look at another highly anticipated international union that better not implode, the royal wedding. Harriet Cross, who's the British General Consul to New England, joins us for an official primer.
Then the Rachel Maddow of New England, a.k.a. Sue O'Connell, joins us to talk about her interview with GOP gubernatorial candidate and self-described homophobe Scott Lively. From there, we're tripping with Michael Pollan, whose latest book looks at how psychedelic drugs could be key to treating depression and other psychological ailments. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, WGBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Wednesday. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
You just got it in there, didn't you, there, Marjorie?
Just made it.
Slipped that old microphone on.
I slipped on.
It might be
minute.
Prudent to put those speculations about Donald Trump winning the Nobel Peace Prize on hold, at least temporarily. North Korea, as you know, in denouncing military exercises between South Korea and the U.S., is calling off talks with Seoul, and he's now threatening to pull out of the summit in June with President Trump. So is this Kim Jong-un being strategic, impulsive? Is it to be expected? Joining us for her take on this and other headlines is national security expert Julia Kayyem. Juliet's on the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School, a CNN contributor, and a CEO of Zemcar. Hi, Juliet.
Hello.
Hello, Juliet. Well, we'll get back to North Korea in just a second.
You're going to talk about the royal wedding?
We are, but not with you.
I know.
We are
you
talking about
so
it. We're so excited.
Harriet
I'm excited.
Cross coming next.
Yeah,
Consul General's next.
She's coming from
Great
Britain.
Yeah, I know.
She has all the scoop.
She's not coming from Great Britain. She's coming from down the street.
But she has it in her bloodstream.
That's right.
I will say that I have a furniture delivery from Wayfair coming. On Saturday, and they give you like a four-hour window, which is totally legitimate. I'm like, take your time. I'll just be in front of the TV.
Yeah.
It's 8 to 12. Take your come at 2.
Well, I think it starts at 7, doesn't it?
I don't know. All I know is CNN sent everyone but me.
Anderson Cooper is going. Well, let's get back to it.
I know. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, fine.
Let's talk about something else that does matter, I suppose. Oh, I'm going to sneeze, Jim.
Okay, transcripts are out from the interviews with Trump Jr. et al. Vis-a-vis the infamous June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower. What did we learn that we didn't know, Juliet Kayyem?
So we learned a couple of things. I think the most interesting thing that people are focusing on specifically is Don Jr. makes a phone call after he meets with the Russians, 4-minute phone call. He says he doesn't remember who it was to. And so, you know, one could surmise, as Steve Bannon did, remind everyone, that phone call may have gone to Pops about what was happening. So there's like sort of little specific tidbits that this idea, which I've long thought, the idea that this meeting took place and Trump did not know about it seems surreal. It seems not plausible in my mind, given the extent to which Trump knew everything that was going on.
Well, wasn't he in the building? Don't we know that he was in the building at the time?
Can't they see from your phone?
Yeah, well, one would surmise that Bob Mueller has asked for. Oh, it was a block call. Has asked for.
Oh, okay.
For the
records.
Phone records.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the bigger issue is this, and let's just not forget it as we look at the little pieces of what was said during that meeting and who was in the room and who's not. What we do know now, and this is not speculation or conspiracy, is senior members of the Trump campaign and the family met for the purpose of getting information from people who they knew to be Russian operatives about Hillary Clinton. And they did not tell the FBI. They did not alert anyone. They did not say no. And on the Russian side, to the extent that that is an intelligence that their request for the meeting was an intelligence operation to assess the vulnerabilities or the receptiveness of the Trump family and the Trump campaign, they got it. And so whatever content was said in that room, let's just put a big bow around it saying, you know, we don't have to look for conspiracies anymore. This is a campaign that knew it was meeting with people who had compromised information about Hillary Clinton, and those people were Russians.
Well, and also, beyond dispute, is the infamous, was it a text or from Junior? If it's what you say it is, I love it.
And I love it.
To the,
yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if this is beginning to matter less and less. I mean, you see a very effective...
To whom?
To Congress, to the American
public.
Probably.
I mean,
you see people... the Trump administration has been very effective in undermining the credibility of Robert Mueller, which is incredible since he is an American hero and a patriot and all that kind of
stuff.
So
I don't know if the polling is actually on your side. I mean, I think the base has long thought Mueller was out for a witch hunt. But I think the polling suggests that this is a man... I mean, you know, the way he's played the media media, in other words, not playing the media, has been really smart. He just has sort of went into hiding and is doing his thing. And I think you just have to look at what Mueller is doing in two different lenses. One is the political one, which is all the noisiness that you see every night on CNN and MSNBC and Fox. And the other is the legal one. To that extent, I think Mueller, after a year, has been incredibly successful.
Right.
A couple dozen indictments, four plea deals of senior members of the Trump campaign, evidence and subpoenas relating to everything from money laundering to prostitutes to Michael Cohen to to election collusion. So to me, in a year, that's a pretty successful. You have it might be five, four plea deals from not the riffraff, not the coffee boys, but the former national security advisor, the former campaign chair. Well, that's not a plea, former deputy campaign chairman.
Well, and also for people on the Trump side of the equation who were hopeful that a federal judge was going to dismiss the charges against Paul Manafort yesterday based upon the initial reaction. The answer there was no. Also, I don't know if the poll, I am a believer in polls.
Yeah.
But on this situation, I'm not sure that even if people are honest with the pollster, it reflects the reality. I think right now it's just a waiting game.
Yeah.
I mean, when Mueller comes,
Congress
going to be laser-like.
We have a Republican-dominated House and Senate that may or may not change in the 2018 midterms. So you wonder if they do anything. I mean, you've seen.
The question is public. Listen, there are only how many Republican senators who have even stood by the side of their American hero colleague who's on his deathbed,
Five.
If they're
well, exactly.
not going to stand with him.
Well, exactly. That's
but again, the question is, how strong is the ultimate report, and can they resist the town halls at home if
right.
people
that's, I mean,
rise
that,
up? I mean, I think what's going on
and
now
I think it's remarkable what's going on, because as we say every week, we only know 10% of what Mueller knows. But remember, there is likely or there will be a report. And I suspect, just given everything going on, that the cases will continue, the plea agreements, the grand jury. But that report could show a president so compromised by a foreign power, whether it's the money, whether it's the campaign, or whether it's the prostitutes, so compromised that it's going to be a hard narrative to ignore. Now, whether it leads to something bigger, I don't know. But,
you know,
I mean, I think it's important for us to know, was the president compromise. And I don't he's an agent of a foreign power. I just mean he's trying to, you know, the best case scenario for him is he's so in debt. He's done this crazy hooker stuff, you know, all this stuff. His campaign is so
allegedly.
Crazy. Yeah, all of them allegedly. But that all of those things are done in a way in which he's compromised, because what's motivating him isn't to help the Russians, but to protect the money and to protect the family and to protect the marriage and to protect his legitimacy as president. That's the question. And whether it leads to him being president or not, to be honest, at this stage, that seems secondary.
You know, one last thing about this transcript stuff today. I didn't think of it until you mentioned the word compromise a couple of times, and I briefly read something about it before it went on the air, is part of the transcripts has Donald Jr. saying his father, quote, may have some involvement in drafting the infamous deceptive statement on Air Force One. May have? I mean, that's pretty serious stuff, too. And by the way, he does outright say, as I'm reading as you're talking, my father didn't know anything about this meeting, but as you say, he can't identify who it was he was calling on the phone, so who knows. We're talking to Juliette Kimes. So the North Korea...
Just on that point, just quickly... those two statements from Don Jr. are inconsistent, right? So he says he may have had dealings with what was said, but
in the statement, right.
In the statement, but his dad had nothing to do with the meeting. Why then would the dad be relevant to why wouldn't you protect your father and not call him to help you give the press statement? I mean, the only reason why you're calling the dad is because you realize this thing is bigger than just you, right? He compromised his dad on calling him to help with the press release.
We're talking to Juliette Kimes. So everybody listening to the show doesn't need us to say what Kim Jong-un has said last couple of days. Everybody's heard it, broken off talks with Seoul because of these joint military exercises between South Korea and the U.S., and then basically saying, you know, if they're talking about outright denuclearization, which, by the way, he had been talking about, mm-hmm. the U.S., then maybe these talks aren't going to happen at all. The president was just asked if the summit is still on for June 12th. He said, we'll have to see. This is what happens in high-stakes international negotiations, right? There's not anything that should cause anybody alarm who's hoping for a decent outcome here, or is there?
Well, I think because this one was done at the principal level, in other words, mm-hmm. There's no groundwork being laid of what are going to be the areas of contention, what will we say or not say.
Well, we don't
say,
know if Pompeo's worked out something with them.
Everyone knew when Trump said that the meeting will take place for a denuclearized North Korea, everyone knew who studies this that Kim had never agreed to that. Mm-hmm. So why he wakes up this morning or yesterday to say that can't be a precondition. You normally lay down the preconditions of what is going to be the meeting. And that's why, you know, and let's just say that, I mean, Trump did raise the expectations by saying everyone thinks he should get the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, that's just, you know, that is raising expectations. You want to go into a meeting like this with the handshake is success, right? If nothing else comes from this, at least there's a communication. You get the worker bees to figure out what it is. Kim's already gotten what he wants. He does not need this meeting. He does not need. He
I mean, he got what he wanted, which was the president to agree to a meeting.
That he's a good guy, getting the secretary to jump on a plane. He gives up three Americans who mean nothing to him, right? I mean, he'll pick up three more Americans in 6 months. He is not going to denuclearize. He's got South Korea bending over backwards to make this happen. He's gotten everything he wants, and he has a successful nuclear arsenal. So why does he need the meeting?
Well, because he's got economic problems and he wants help. And
you
theoretically,
think that, I don't
he
think,
won't get them.
Yeah, I mean, from
I'm not Listen, I'm not disputing your analysis. Yeah. I don't know enough to dispute it. I'm just saying, from what I read, and I'm sure you read too, he's got deep economic problems and sanctions are hurting him. And I assume he wants them removed or lessened with the least giveaway on his part. But, you know, I heard on your station last night on CNN, what to me is obvious is this message is not even so much likely for the United States and the world. It's for his own people to say, don't worry, I'm not giving away the store. You've spent all this money on developing a nuclear arsenal. I'm not giving it away for nothing. And so the message is transmitted to his people, where he hopefully mutes down
because
whatever
concern there
is.
Because that was the reason people were starving to death. Is
exactly.
Because we had to spend all the money. Right. Couldn't feed you because we could build the nuclear arsenal.
Right.
It always seemed that. But I am hopeful that something comes out of this, because obviously this guy's a little whacked, seems to me.
Well, we don't even know how. I mean, I used to say that too, Marjorie, and maybe he is. I don't know how whacked.
Yeah, I mean,
we really don't know how whacked.
I think it's very unusual to kill your family members. Have them
That is probably a very good point.
But no, that is when you say that, I mean, I think that's what I think that's a. I think, I, honestly, Marjorie, I think that's somewhat problematic, because to say, well, you just hope something works out. I think that's sort of how the White House has been looking at it. Like a deal for a deal's sake is good. And you sort of have to think through, okay, here's a man who kills his family members, who has a country that, you know, is starving, who's a horrible, horrible human rights abuser. And what's the deal we want, right? I mean, are we really interested in opening up markets to North Korea? Not really, you know? I mean, we just closed them off to Iran. I mean, I don't get why Kim would be motivated for a deal.
Well, we want him not to blow up a city in the United States of America with a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's what we
that
don't
would be good.
That's
yeah.
what we do not want.
Yeah.
So I think that we I would hope that we could do something that would make that less likely.
Yeah,
that's what I'm
right.
hoping for. When they said they could reach California, that made me extremely nervous.
Yes.
And when they said that very soon they'd be able to reach Washington, D.C., that made me very nervous too. But let me talk to you about something else. It just makes me plain old embarrassed. I mean, I realize Hamas is horrible, a terrorist organization. They were elected in Palestine, and they've been running the show, and maybe they bust these people in to go up against the wall between them and Israel the other day while the ceremony was going on, the beginning of the new location of the embassy in Jerusalem instead of Tel Aviv. But it really upset me that we could not, as the United States of America, express regret for the loss of life of these Palestinians, some of whom were children that were shot in the head. And that when Nikki Haley gets up there and says in the United Nations, no other country would have reacted with more restraint, I think the United States military...
And that the demonstrations had nothing to do with the embassy.
Yeah. Just a coincidence.
You know, what... I think so much better of the United States military than she does.
Yeah.
I do not see United States military men standing and taking aim at the heads
at children.
Of children with guns. They could have. They didn't need to shoot all these people. What are we up to, 60 people now?
Yeah. Somewhere in the
neighborhood. And then the injured.
I guess, I know we're not supposed to apologize, but this is our country that won't express regret.
Regret. Right. I mean, you're not wrong. And so,
it just breaks your heart.
And you do have to wonder, or at least, you know, why was Israel willing to be so aggressive? They've had Hamas rallies before. There's lots of activity. Well, you know, why did it lead to this moment? And one is because they knew what the U.S. reaction would be. The U.S. reaction under Bush or Obama would not have been this reaction, which is you are justified. You were cautious, and it has nothing to do with the opening of an embassy that everyone said. One of the reasons why we're not opening up an embassy there is because of not being an honest broker in a peace arrangement that everyone across the political spectrum, for the most part, agrees to. So Hamas is a terrorist organization. There is no question about it. It does not recognize Israel.
Well, actually, it wants its destruction.
No one's carrying any water for Hamas.
It is still legitimate to view Israel's actions as not commiserate with the threat. But the U.S. won't say that now. And the U.S. will actually say worse. What we said was worse than silence. In other words, if we just say, look, that's an internal Israeli matter, that would have been better than what we said. Because what we said with, you know, Ivanka opening up in her white dress, the embassy, you know, opening up the... No, she wasn't opening up her dress. Opening up the embassy in her white dress and the images of these dead children. That's an image that gets... That's used for all sorts of nefarious recruitment purposes.
You wonder, I mean, is the rest of the world saying, okay, this is a new regime in the United States of America, and this is Donald Trump, and so let's separate him from the history of the United States of America? Not that we haven't made mistakes, but this is a pretty cruel one. Or
128 countries signed a UN resolution condemning
what happened.
The moving of the
our UN ambassador is not brave enough to sit there and listen to the Palestinian rep, right? She has to walk out, right? I mean, what is this walk out thing by all of them? Pence did it too. Like, what is, are we for? Like, we're the United States of America. Like, we can handle it. Like, it's just...
Well, also juxtapose it. The president of the United States is okay was sitting down with a person who has done what has been done to his people, Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
But it's not okay for Nikki Haley to be there with a Palestinian
representative. It's such a sign of weakness on our part.
Well,
and they think
no
it's strange.
There's also no nuance.
Yeah.
But I guess what my question was, is this doing long-term damage to the United States of America? You think so?
I think let's just never forget for how some people feel about this day and age. You know, look, he has a lot of supporters, but, you know, 10 years ago, we elected Barack Obama. So, the country changes. But if you, the Europeans right now are not viewing this as, can we just hold our breath until he's no longer president? Because that could be 6 years from now. Meanwhile, lots of stuff are happening in the European Union. And if you look at what Trump has done, right, applaud our enemies, North Korea, Russia, you know, all the, you know, totalitarian governments throughout the country, and isolate Germany, France, Britain. What is that philosophy?
And threaten them with sanctions
if
they continue
to
deal
with Iran.
Oh, that
was a good move, right. Yeah, that was...
So, the point I was trying to make here, so that we don't get flooded with emails saying you're on the wrong side or the right side or whatever of the Israeli-Palestinian situation. I think the point you're making, one, Nikki Haley didn't have to sit there and say something as preposterous as that had nothing to do with the moving of the embassy. She could say, we believe we did the right thing. We honored a commitment. And again, as you say, however, We express regret for the loss of lives,
exactly.
Even if they believe
exactly.
that it's all Hamas-inspired.
Exactly, and to have
that's
some
all.
Basic compassion.
I agree.
Right. That's but that's the, you know, the compassion component, whether it's a comment made about John McCain and apologizing or this, that's just lacking. I mean, it's lacking in, we're not even getting to it today, but in our new immigration enforcement efforts, of which we're separating families and putting kids in military areas.
Well, they can go into foster care
or whatever,
as John Kelly says.
I told you so. I get to say, I told you so.
About John Kelly.
Yeah, it's remarkable. All of the great stories about
and
him.
We had the Trump guy in Pennsylvania. Did very well in the Republican primary.
You know, can we, since you mentioned McCain a couple of times, you know, John King brought this to our attention yesterday. I hadn't been looking at Trump's tweets before the show. Is Trump's tweets, obviously the effort on the part of the White House is to turn the discussion about why won't you apologize on behalf of Kelly Sadler, or why won't Kelly Sadler herself publicly apologize for what she said he's dying anyway about John McCain vis-a-vis the what is likely to now be the confirmation of Gina Haspel. By the way, she just got out of a key Senate committee with two Democratic votes, Warner and Manchin. So she's clearly on her way to confirmation as head of the CIA. They're attempting to turn this into an issue, which is not an illegitimate issue, a concern about leaks. I think both issues are legitimate issues. But the amazing thing that John brought to our attention, which I hadn't seen, is in his tweet, one of his tweets about the leaks yesterday, Donald Trump uses the term traitors and cowards to talk about his own
people.
Staff in the White House who are leaking. Now, beyond the fact that that is just otherworldly, the one thing I have to say, and I mean this as a serious comment, I know you're going to take this as a joke, but I don't mean it as a joke. We had a staff meeting with our coworkers from Boston Public Radio. I don't think there are many national security issues we deal with.
I don't think so.
And then all of a sudden you found out that something you said in that meeting, which is in the grand scheme of things, totally unimportant, got out. We'd both be pretty upset about this.
Yes, we would.
If you're the president of the United States and you know you're working in a building where there are a significant number of your own people who are leaking stuff, I mean, how do you do your meetings?
So why?
How do you? Well, they don't support his agenda.
No, well, I think that's true. Look, all presidency, all White Houses, having worked at agencies, so I certainly know this. All White Houses have different camps on different issues, and so why do this? And all of them leak. So why is this one so bad? And it's got to get down to because the policy process is not inclusive. In other words, why would you go out to the media? You know, you win or lose a policy debate, fine. But it's all about process, right? Because decisions are being made by tweet, they're being made by Steve Miller, they're being made by Bolton, and that the apparatus is not having a voice. So part of why the leaks are happening, for 10,000 reasons, some of it's the personalities who are there, is also because the policy process is broken. The White House is not doing what it ought to do, which is, you know, it's being run by, you know, essentially tweets and three people. I will say on the other side, and this is starting to be true later, you know, closer to 2 years in the administration, is this woman, Kelly, right? So I have no doubt she wants to apologize.
Well, she told Meghan McCain
she would make a public. I have no doubt that she was stopped from apologizing because we don't apologize because we're the White House. Kelly, she's going to have to look for a job one day. And the Globe just had a story this morning about, you know, these people cannot get jobs. So if
having the White House on your resume is not an asset, which historically it has.
Yeah, been. I mean, you know, the idea, you know, that they said not all of us can work for Fox News. So a lot of them are heading home. They're going to, you know, small law firms or whatever. You can't believe this, right? I mean, in terms of what working at the White House should be. So I sometimes wonder if this is like reputational protection as well as people begin to look at the exit. It's too late for people like John Kelly and Kelly Sadler, but are you going to talk about the royal wedding now?
Well,
are you dying to talk? Do you have something to say?
I love Meghan Markle. I mean, I think she is just fantastic. I love Suits before anyone knew what Suits was. She is just great. And I feel bad for her. And in the scheme of things, this is not a big deal, but it's a big deal.
To miss your father.
I mean, in the end, she's not a princess. She's just a daughter. You know?
She's just a daughter. That's true. Well, we're going to talk to the princess.
I could talk about this. I could talk about
this
nonstop.
Oh,
I know. Did you know what I asked for Mother's Day from my family?
I don't want to.
They not mock me. They not mock me on Saturday morning. That they just come downstairs
what time
and
are you
they go
up?
Six.
Okay. Yeah, and the
six.
Ceremony start doesn't start till
the
7.
The pregame
so
show starts at 4 a.m. on CNN.
You have three hours of the pregame.
No.
The ceremony is going to start at 7. We'll double-check this with the Council General, but that's my understanding. From me. It starts at 7, so that's plenty of time. 6 o'clock is plenty of time. A nice cup of coffee. Sit on the couch. Get ready.
Wait for my Wayfair delivery.
Can't wait for her.
8 to 12. Take your time, Wayfair. Yeah, take your time.
What are you getting from Wayfair?
New patio furniture.
Boston.
Oh,
you know, the president, head of Wayfair, was at Band in Boston the other night.
I know.
They're fantastic.
He looked like he was about 12.
I'm gonna do I could do a plug for my company, Zemcar. Come on, everyone. But I'm going to do a plug for Wayfair.
Okay,
we love them.
Well, I tell you, you have to get in the car and listen to our next segment because you know what we're talking about up next?
I know.
It's Royal Wedding Central here at Boston Public Radio. I just want to tell you that.
Before you do that, by the way, on a serious note, I know the wedding is a serious note, too. The story broke just minutes ago. Michigan State University has agreed to pay $500 million to 332 victims, survivors of Larry Nassar, who, as we know, is the Olympic doctor.
I want you to get your head around that.
I know,
number.
It's unbelievable.
332 girls.
Yeah. 332.
You tell me this was just one doctor. This was an entire apparatus
totally with you.
Meant to protect him.
Totally with you.
National
Good
Security
to see you,
Expert Julia.
Okay,
Kime
Megan and Harry will be watching.
Oh, my God.
I love them.
I love them.
Bye.
Juliette Kime joins us every week. She's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School, a CNN contributor and CEO of Zemcar. Up next, as promised, the royal wedding from National Security. We are moving on to a conversation that some of you may think of the National Enquirer, but not me. We're going to get the official royal wedding primer with Harriet Cross, the British Consul to New England. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're unlike Marjorie Egan, or now I know Juliette Kime, and are not caught up in the delirium of royal wedding fever, maybe you should approach it not so much for the dramatics, but for the possible diplomacy. As U.S. Ambassador to the U.K. Woody Johnson put it, quote, "The marriage between Prince Harry and Meghan Markle is symbolic of the special relationship between the U.K. and the U.S. Joining us is someone who can talk about the wedding, both the pomp and the politics, is Harriet Cross. Harriet is the British Consul General to New England. Harriet Cross, it's great to see you. How are you?
Good morning, Jim.
Look at the smile on your face today.
This is a very exciting weekend. Okay, so the first thing I want to know
it's not the first thing. The first thing is she brought a gift.
She
not
did
for
yes.
us.
She did
but
me
for
gift.
You, Marjorie.
I think it might be British.
What did you bring,
food.
Consul General?
It's for the person who is interested in royal weddings. So
oh,
this is
God.
Vintage. I was in the United Kingdom last week.
Yes, you were.
And
okay.
I saw this in a vintage store.
Oh, my God.
What is it? Describe it, please. Marjorie.
This is in commemoration of the royal wedding of His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, and Lady Diana Spencer. Look at this. It's got their
picture.
It's
a collector's item.
On the, oh, my God.
Could you bring me some clotted cream or something
very
at
much.
Least?
Next time.
Next time.
Oh,
look how
this
happy
is
Marjorie
wonderful.
Egan is.
Thank you very much. Well, I do love these royal weddings. So I want to know, when you are the British Consul General to New England, what is your plan for Saturday? I mean, do you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and watch the pregame? Can you wait till 6 and have the ceremony starts at 7? Correct. I mean, what is the protocol when you're in a position that you're in?
Well, you know, one of the things about this royal wedding is it's kind of a little bit laid back, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
You know, the royal family said we don't want people making a huge big deal out of this. You know, you do whatever is appropriate for you in the places where you are.
Okay.
So there are a number of different events happening around Boston. In fact, I know that the Plymouth Plantation is doing a royal wedding watching kind of ceremony.
Oh, they are?
Which they invited me to, but to get to Plymouth by 7 a.m.
Yeah,
is
forget
a little
that. Forget that. That's a great place, though. We love the Plymouth Plantation. Everybody's in their outfits all the time.
So
right?
Wait a second. Don't avoid the question. What are you doing, Consul General, on Saturday morning?
I am having an intimate viewing party.
Oh, an intimate viewing party.
What does that mean? You and your husband in your house?
Kind.
Is that what it means?
Friends.
Okay.
That's the very best kind. So we've all talked about the fact that she's biracial, she's an American, she's a divorcee, she's someone with an extensive career as an actress before this. How big of a deal is this in terms of, I mean, I know he's not the heir, but he's the brother of the heir, could be king someday.
Yeah.
So how big of a deal is this break in protocol, as it were? I mean, I remember Diana having to go to the royal gynecologist. I remember that many years ago. Meghan's not doing that. She was married before.
No. I don't think it's a... I wouldn't call it a break in protocol. He's marrying the woman he loves, which is fabulous. I think the UK is a really diverse place. I mean, London, there must be, you know, you hear language, different languages spoken on the tube. You know, it's kind of fizzing all over the UK with people of all sorts of different ethnicities, nationalities, speaking different languages. So in some ways, it's not a surprise for us to see that our prince is marrying somebody who's not a kind of stereotypical white British woman.
Yeah.
And that's quite exciting. And I think people are pleased that it's kind of representative of the modern Britain, I suppose.
And you know what else you always hear? That, oh, well, we spent too much money in the monarchy. But I'm not an American, but I have a sense that at times like this, the monarchy is quite beloved.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. I think so. I mean, the Queen has been on the throne for decades, you know, she's in her 90s. They've been through rough times, and the Queen herself has highlighted some of those rough times, not least the death of Prince Harry's mother, Princess Diana. But I think they're in a really strong place at the moment, and they are loved. The Duchess of Cornwall, Prince Charles's new wife, has actually been really welcomed into British society, I think. She's quite loved now as well.
Camilla Parker Bowles.
Yeah,
well,
I know
we
it is.
Love her. You know why?
Because don't.
No, I'm not going to go into that.
Okay,
I'm going to say because, you know, many men of his stature and his income would not be marrying the woman that's his own age, who's not the knockout in the traditional sense that Princess Diana
He's
was.
In love.
He was in love with a non-traditional woman when you think about what some creepy men usually go for. You know, women that could be their granddaughters, and he didn't do that.
We do that in the United States,
too.
Now, Consul General Harry Cross, you have to explain, we've had this discussion in the past in other settings, but let's have it again.
Okay.
Explain to me why people like Marjorie Egan, she's an American, I think you know that,
correct? I'm an American, yes, I am.
Is as excited, and she is wicked excited about this,
I'm
not
excited.
Mildly excited. Tell me why people like Marjorie are as excited about this as they are. And I don't think it's just the gender divide, as someone said to us on the show the other day. What do you think that's all about?
You know, I think in this particular case, the story of Prince Harry is really something special. I mean, this is a boy who lost his mother at a really young age. He saw the damage that happened because of that divorce, and that maybe because his father didn't marry the woman that he loved originally. And it's a bit of a fairy tale story to find that he's now come out of the end of a hard childhood. You know, anybody who loses a parent, it's a hard thing to deal with. And not only has he come out of the other end of that, but he's spending time working on mental health charities. He's got a charity called Heads Together, which has done some work here in Boston.
What does it do?
It particularly focuses on servicemen and women who have got mental health issues as a result of their service. They've done some work with Homebase here. So that's a good example of where not only has he sorted himself out, but he's happy to talk about these issues. And I think that makes him quite special, and that he's been brave enough to go out there and marry a non-traditional woman, somebody that has got an interesting background. And I think that's a fairy tale story in itself. And it brings the UK and the US together in a way that we've never been bound together by these royal ties before. I think that's really exciting.
Well, you know, I mentioned Woody Johnson, who I think is the owner of the Jets, or the former owner of the New York Jets, if people are familiar with the name, and the ambassador to the UK. The implication in the story about him, or maybe another one I read this morning, is with, you know, some occasional conflict between, you know, the prime minister and our president on a variety of issues, and obviously a strong but occasionally fractured, maybe that's too strong a word, relationship, whatever it is, that they have the potential to be agents of soft diplomacy, was the term I read this morning. Do you buy that the Harry Markle thing? You're nodding in agreement. Tell me how and why.
I think soft power is really, really important. And the UK's got an awful lot of it. And the royal family is a really good example of that. People are interested in what these people are doing. So when Prince Harry chooses to work with wounded veterans, that's meaningful. When he chooses to talk about mental health, it's not just anybody doing that because of his background and the power that he wields. I mean, constitutionally, the royal family are built within the system. They're not a kind of added extra. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, they don't wield political power, but technically they could. You know, it's there. I think it's an important part of the British makeup, and the fact that people all around the world, I mean, we talk about the excitement in the US, but
they're
China,
saying billions
Japan,
of people yeah. are going to yeah. watch this
I
wedding.
Yeah.
Billions. So that's the US side. You're explaining. That's actually a pretty good explanation, too, Consul General Harry Cross, who we're talking to. How about the Brits? Is there any resentment? I'm sure there's some, but how widespread is the concern about the fact? I mean, this is a subsidized monarchy, obviously. I don't mean that in a pejorative way. It is what it is.
Yep.
I'm sure some people are struggling. How do you reconcile that? How does the average Brit reconcile that, the existence of that, with democracy?
I think if you're talking about taxpayers' money, I think taxpayers get a pretty good return on the royal family.
How so?
Well, because they bring in tourist dollars, if you like. That's,
absolutely.
That's one angle.
That's the market.
And, well, they do.
She could be the consul general to New England.
Let me tell you, I met the Queen in 2010.
Let's talk about that. What was that like?
I was organizing her visit to New York in 2010. She came to the United Nations.
We did not know that,
yes.
Jim.
So I planned her whole visit. So I was in charge of where she goes, who she meets, etc. Anyway, I knew that she had an hour in her schedule that she needed a kind of a break. So I thought, well, we'll have to book the Waldorf, obviously. You know, this is going to cost a lot of money, but we'll have to book the Waldorf. Anyway, I spoke to her people. They said, oh, we don't need the Waldorf. Just a little room in the UN will be fine.
Oh.
That's where she spent her hour break, in a basement room in the United
How
Nations.
How nervous were you doing that planning? I didn't know you'd done that
yeah.
either. How nervous were you?
I wasn't that nervous, actually, because she's just got such a great team of people around her, and they're used to doing these visits all the time. But what I'm trying to say is they're not actually very demanding in the way that you would find a Hollywood celebrity might be.
That's right.
So
yeah,
it's a huge use of money.
The Hollywood celebrity is always demanding everything they have to have in their dressing room, and it has to be this many bottles yeah. of water and this certain kind of water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you know what I've always wondered about the Queen is, do you have any idea why she always carries her little purse? You know, it seems to me she could have someone, a lady in waiting, carry her purse if she needed her lipstick or she needed her cell phone, whatever it is. You know, she's always, I've never seen her without the purse, even when she's in her own castle there, or palace, or
yeah.
Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
She's got the purse.
Well, I throw it back to you. You've got your handbag sitting next to you, Marjorie.
So maybe I don't have any.
Well, I'm not going to be carrying it around for her.
Exactly.
That's why.
So, but maybe you want to be near your lipstick and
so
your
maybe
little
it.
Handkerchief
okay.
and this sort of thing.
Do you know what else I wonder about? Not to get off the subject of the royal wedding. I think Will and Kate have been great ambassadors for Great Britain, too,
yeah.
because they seem to be very much in love. They had just had their third baby now.
Yeah.
Plus, she was home about 10 minutes after she gave
right.
birth. It
and
was unbelievable.
And who love those pictures when they come out the steps of the hospital and
yeah.
they, the little baby in the arms?
Yeah.
I mean, it is just like wonderful public relations, I think, for Great Britain. That's why I think it was so devastated when Diana and Prince Charles split up, you know, because
yeah.
the fairy tale was ruined.
It was, but I think at the same time it showed that these, in many ways, the royal family is a normal family.
Right,
in many ways. So it's no bad thing that we see a divorce, because lots of regular people get divorced, and we see it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tragedy what happened to Princess Diana subsequent to that,
yes.
and I don't want to downplay that. So her two sons have come out and found stable marriages, and Prince Charles has found love again. And divorce happens, and people get over it and move on. And great that the royal family is showing us that in their own lives.
So since Consul General Harriet Cross, you've been quite candid about some of the issues that people have to deal with. What's with the father, the Markle father deal? Juliet was saying a few minutes
yes.
ago how sad it was. I mean, we originally heard that the royals were upset because he had been selling these photos to British tabloids about him preparing for the wedding. Then I heard on CNN last night, it actually isn't that, and he was obviously supposed to walk his daughter down the aisle, that he's having heart surgery a couple of days before. One, what is the truth as far as you know? And two, how upset is everybody that the bride's father apparently is not going to be there?
Well, I don't have any more information than you do. I think it's really telling that, that Prince Harry, on a number of occasions, has said, give us some space. You know, these are personal matters that we're dealing with. So I don't know whether he'll make it or not. I hope for Meghan's sake that he will, because it's clear that both of them want him to be there. And we'll just have to see what happens.
Although, you know what would be, I mean, not that it's your father and that's tradition to have your father walk you down the aisle, but there were reports yesterday that her mother would step in and walk her down the aisle. And, you know, it's not a bad second choice to see
or
a mother.
Or the other prince may or something. They're making the comment. Have you met him, by the way, Harry?
No, I haven't met Harry. I saw him from a distance in New York, but I didn't get to say hello.
And did you meet the Queen when she was there?
Sure, yeah.
And what was that like? What do you mean, sure, yeah? I mean, what was that like? I mean, what is she like in a one-on-one?
Just a really graceful, nice woman.
Is she warm?
Absolutely, yeah. And doesn't stand on ceremony. I think that's what's really interesting. I actually met her in Trinidad and Tobago before I met her in New York, so I've met her on a couple of occasions. And she just headed... A couple of us were standing at this garden party, and she just headed towards us. Nobody told her she was going to come our way, and shook her hands and said hello. And you were really just
matter-of-fact. Barack Obama called into our radio show the final appearance for Deval Patrick. I was so nervous, I almost couldn't breathe until the phone rang. You weren't anxiety-ridden dealing with the Queen of England, no?
Well, she's my boss, I guess. So you're
she
all,
is
you're
your boss,
a little bit,
I would say.
Nervous when your boss is around.
But no, you...
No, I think not, really. Okay. It's my job.
We're talking to Harry Cross, Consul General of New England from the UK.
What is the etiquette? Are you supposed to curtsy to the Queen when you first greet her?
You plan on meeting her, or what are you...
No, I'm not, but I'm just curious.
I think in this day and age, and it may have been different when the Queen came to the throne in the 50s, mm-hmm. I think there's a certain amount of elasticity as to how you show your deference or your respect.
Okay. You know, when Princess Diana died, that was when newspapers were not as broke as they are now, and I got to go cover her funeral. Oh. And there were a couple of things which I thought were incredible. I think the British started the whole tradition, which you see after so many tragedies now, of people placing flowers.
I think I've read that, actually.
Because there were these mountains of flowers, and I covered as a reporter a lot of, you know, people getting killed and so forth. Never seen that before. And I remember Kensington Palace was just a wall of flowers. And I also remember seeing those two young boys who were then teenagers walking behind their mother's casket as it rolled down the streets. It was just a very moving thing.
Yeah.
And how devastated people were in Great Britain.
Yeah, they were. And I was there in London at that time as well. It was my first year in the Foreign Office. And I was trying to find a flat and doing all that. And just it was a very surreal feeling of London kind of came to a bit of a standstill. There was this kind of eerie silence over lots of it because people were shocked. And I think this is another reason, going back to your question about Meghan Markle's father, that Prince Harry is so... he wants to protect his privacy because I think he sees the media and the paparazzi as having had a role in his mother's death.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Well, that was
theoretically chasing after the car. Was that not? Was that what the thing was?
Yeah, and that was one of the stories we heard about the father. I don't know if that was a true story or not a true story, but that he was also being chased by the paparazzi and pulled over to the side of the road and was very shaken by it. You know, you don't hear about that in the United States the way you do, but you have all those tabloids in London that are probably all competing with each other for the stories. Yeah. What do you have, about 10 different tabloids in London? There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot. And nowadays it's websites as much as paper.
The websites,
tabloids.
That's right. Yeah.
So I don't want you to leave here in a few minutes, Harry Cross, and think that I don't care about the same issues you and Marjorie do, because while she's concerned about the wedding, I am obsessed with the fact that Philip is the best-looking 90-something-year-old man who has ever... How old is this? Is he 95 or something now?
I think he might even be older than that.
One of the best-looking older men who has ever...
Did you see The Crown?
Of course, yeah.
Wonderful. You know what else I loved? I loved Victoria.
Oh, yes.
My goodness, that was great, too. You know, I don't know enough of the history to know if that was... If she was as steely and tough and as smart.
Oh, I think so.
But it's wonderful because she was so young when she became the queen.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful series on PBS, too.
Okay, now, since part of your job, obviously, is your job is to represent the UK and New England. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Consul General? Okay.
Yes.
So we found in the Boston Globe today or yesterday some facts about Meghan Markle.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to test you on them for a few minutes, okay? Is it true or false that Meghan Markle has a Donald Trump connection, Harry Cross? Yes or no?
Yes.
And what is the connection, please? That is correct, by the way. That was the correct answer.
I was guessing because I had a 50% chance of being
you
right.
You did. And do you have any idea what the connection
no, I
is?
Don't.
Okay, fine. In 2006, according to Mark Shanahan, she worked as a so-called briefcase girl on Deal or No Deal, one of my favorite shows, a TV game show hosted by Howie Mandel, etc. Oh, and Trump was a guest on the show in part to promote The Apprentice. So you can remember that
okay,
whenever
remember
you're asked.
That.
Do you have a question for her, Marjorie?
Certainly. Do you know...
You're well prepared, I can tell.
I am not. I am not as well prepared as I should be on this
yes.
one. Did you know that Markle learned everything she knows about dealing with fans from Yasmin Bleach?
No.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's the correct answer. That's the wrong answer.
Was on Baywatch, and when Marco was 13, she worked at Humphrey Yogurt, a frozen yogurt shop in Southern California, earning
did.
$4 an hour. One day, Bleeth came in, and Marco, who is a fan, blurted out, "I really like you," in that soft and dry commercial.
Okay, so before you go, on a totally different note for a second, our president is going to be visiting the UK, I think in mid-July, the 13th
yep.
or something. You and I had a discussion after the poisoning on Greater Boston. You were kind to join us.
Yep.
Since I've seen you, your country is not happy about us pulling out of the Iran deal.
Correct.
Your country is not happy about, I know the prime minister specifically spoke to this, about the move of the embassy, U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I know your country was not happy about the speech the president gave about these knifings going on at some unnamed hospital in London where he was speaking to the NRA. And it's not going to be an official state visit. The guy who, I think Speaker of the House it's called, is that in Parliament, doesn't want him to address Parliament. How would you describe the state of UK-US relations in light of these recent events, and how concerned is the average Brit with the behavior of our president on these important international issues?
Mm-hmm. So I think you're quite right to flag up those differences of opinions on Iran and on Jerusalem, because they absolutely exist, and we've made really clear that we don't think either of those decisions were the right ones. But having a difference of opinion is something that you can do when you've got a solid relationship. Sometimes it's harder to suggest that somebody is wrong if you're worried about offending them. But if you've got a solid basis, you can do that, and you can have an exchange of opinions.
And is there a solid? Does there remain a solid basis of a relationship between Trump and May and the others, you think?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I mean, and that's why he's coming on the 13th of July. And the fact that it's a working visit. I mean, there are a number of differentials between what a state visit is and a working visit. But one of the things a working visit gives that a state visit doesn't is that it's an opportunity to talk about political issues. So they will sit down and they will cover some of this ground together and try and look for workable solutions. So, for example, if on Iran, if President Trump has some ideas as to what an alternative would be to this comprehensive program of action, then we're looking forward to hearing about it.
Now, can I give you a little advice before you go?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm sure you came here for this.
Yeah.
If I were you, I would speak to Prime Minister May and tell her the little factoid about the Trump-Markle connection. And if she springs it on him, how great would that be? I mean,
yeah.
Obviously she's impressed. Harry Cross, it is great to see you.
Well, I have one little quick.
Oh, you have a
very,
question?
Very, very
sorry.
Quick, because I know okay. we're out of time here. But is there anything that we should be eating in terms of our celebration on Saturday morning?
Ooh, that's a great
is there
question.
English breakfast item that we can purchase that
oh,
make us more authentic?
Me. Well, I mean, shortcake. And shortbread.
Okay.
Any time of day or night is good.
Shortcake, shortbread. Okay.
Yes,
okay. Keep
you
that
can
in mind.
Dip it in your cup of tea.
Okay.
Yorkshire tea, obviously. That would be my top.
What time
Thank
do you want
you
Marjorie
much.
At your house on Saturday morning, Harry Cross?
Yeah, I'll
you know?
Show with my shortbread.
Yeah.
Harry Cross,
great
thank
to
you
see
very
you.
Much.
So much.
And thank
time.
You very much
Absolute
for my
pleasure.
Authentic
that
Charles
is really
and
nice.
Diana cup of saucer. How great
I
is that?
I am really jealous,
I
I'll
know.
Tell you.
It's black with gold trim. It's
Beautiful.
Very lovely.
Nice
All
to see
engraved.
You. Thanks so much
Harry
for your
Cross
time.
Is the British Consul General to New England. Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you very much for my gift. Up next, Oklahoma has passed an adoption bill that could allow certain adoption agencies, that is, to discriminate against same-sex couples. Sue O'Connell joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us for a take on the social norms, and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell, who's co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News and a BPR contributor. Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Hello.
And hello to you.
Hello, Sue O'Connell. Great to see you, as always.
Good to see you.
So, many people may know that Charlie Baker, of course, he's running for re-election on the Republican side. He got the vast majority of the votes at the state convention, I think almost 70%. Mm-hmm. But Scott Lively got about 28%. And Scott Lively, I think most people would say, is rather extremely off the charts. He thinks that gays control the Third Reich. He wrote this book about the pink swastikas running around Uganda and Europe, like basically advocating for outlawing homosexuals. You had an interview with him,
yes.
And I find that interesting because, of course, you are a homosexual. So
I don't know if I'm a practicing homosexual.
But you want to be.
Well,
I
want to be.
Hope springs eternal. Springtime.
So what was
May.
That like? I missed this.
Well, I'm always amazed, and I don't know if you guys have this experience as well, when someone comes on your show, or your shows in your case, Jim, and they don't Google you before they come on.
Or somebody who works for them says to them, here are their politics, here are the kinds of questions they ask,
et cetera. Yeah, and okay. So, you know, I felt like he hadn't done any prep in terms of knowing who I was. Huh. And so he was acting a bit. I mean, he accused me of ambushing him, asking him questions about his past work as an anti-gay pastor for his church, the work he did in the Northwest to outlaw gay marriage. He's been on trial for...
Wait, did he literally use the word ambush?
Yeah. No, he stopped the interview and said, you are ambushing me. I'm here to talk about the issues, the conservative issues that the voters of Massachusetts, and all you want to talk about is you're ambushing me on my anti-LGBT past. And, you know, at the end of the interview, he said, and you know, you're bringing up this Nazi stuff like I'm accusing him of being a Nazi, which I didn't say Nazi. I didn't say a lot of things. So he's not ready for prime time, in my somewhat objective opinion, in thinking that he had a public advocacy role against marriage equality, against LGBT people. He still has a very narrow viewpoint that homosexuals are in pain, that, you know, we don't want to be gay, that it's a pain, it's a terrible thing that we're carrying around. And yet it's his only public work that he's sort of running on and doesn't want to be questioned about.
But you should fill in some blanks, because I think what you just said is going to give people an unfair impression. There are a lot of people in this country, it's a minority now, who don't support same-sex marriage. He has gone
well beyond that. Yeah.
I mean, can you describe the Ugandan experience just briefly, if you don't mind?
He was on trial here in Massachusetts for his work in Uganda, a lawsuit that was brought by a group there. It ended up that it was dismissed, or it was found that they didn't have standing to bring it. Mm-hmm. And the judge in the case had a lot to say about how repugnant and how terrible Scott Lively's views were. But in Uganda, he was at where it's against the law to be gay, and many homosexuals are killed when they're caught. He was basically walking around supporting that idea, supporting those ideals, and a very well-known gay activist in Uganda was murdered. Scott Lively didn't have anything directly to do with that, but the case was saying, listen, your actions advocating for the criminality of homosexuality in Uganda has contributed to this atmosphere, and we don't want you here. We don't want you spreading this message, this American coming in and doing this. And that's pretty much, you know, how his MO has been, and really taking this extreme viewpoint that homosexuality should be outlawed.
So what's interesting about him is his pushing this aside now, because he didn't talk about this, obviously, at the convention. He said he had some fence mending to do with the LGBT community. He doesn't want you to ask him about it.
Has he done any of that? I mean, obviously...
His idea of fence mending, which I find fascinating, is that he wants to say that the, some of the extreme things he's written and the hyperbole that he has said, he wants to walk back a little bit. But he still fully believes in what he believes in. So yeah. It's not as if he said...
Is that your opinion? Or
no,
does he
no.
Say
that's,
that?
That's he thinks he overstated things too much, but he still is... And he said that he's talked to conservative gays... that support him, and those conservative gays, I can't find them. I'm looking for them. I'm looking for them everywhere. I'm on Facebook.
Well,
I'm
there is a log cabin Republican.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure they're not the conservative supporting gays him. That they want him the government out of their bedroom, he says, and that he's against bullying, but he doesn't think that children in school should be brainwashed into the gay agenda. I mean, this is all language. You know, from the 1980s,
yeah.
This gay agenda business, this criminality.
So should Charlie Baker debate this guy?
I firmly believe he does.
Should or does?
He should. And I don't think it because of any other reason than I think that everybody who has a challenger, especially if you're an incumbent, you owe it to the people to have a debate, at least one debate around it.
Well, I think there's a second issue, too. If your perception of Lively, which I, based on my reading, I find to be accurate, is true... And he is on the ballot, and there are people who've won elections recently, as November mm-hmm. of 2016, who people thought had no chance. Then I think Baker's got an obligation to expose what he believes to be. And Baker has said he's been, some people have criticized. I'm actually curious to know if you think he's been outspoken enough about Lively. He has criticized Lively's position pretty directly.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any wiggle room or any misconception about how Governor Charlie Baker views Scott Lively's viewpoints on that. And he has, when been asked about it, he's been very clear about that.
What do you make about the fact that he got 27% of the vote at the convention?
Well, I think part of it is that he is, in many ways, he's very pro-Second Amendment. He's against abortion, Scott Lively. And I think that that appeals to a certain segment of the delegates. I think there was fewer than 300 that voted for him, just to put this all in context. And I think that some of those people... want a more conservative Republican Party, a more conservative governor here. I think some of them may actually believe. I mean, he got Scott Lively got 2,000 votes last time he ran for governor, the last time around. So there's
as an independent, correct?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, there are people out there who will vote for him because they believe in what Scott Lively's saying. But like I said, last time I was on, there's also some, I think, who really weren't paying that close attention in terms of what the more extreme, hateful views are, voted for him to send a message to Charlie Baker and to the state GOP. And I think that's kind of shameful.
You know, can I just say, for those who say to themselves, who are listening to this and shaking their heads, saying, oh, this is so out of the mainstream, oh, don't... We have a question on the ballot that we've discussed with you that I would argue is pretty out of the mainstream. This state decided to pass this transgender public accommodation provision, and they got enough signatures to put it on the ballot
repeal a law that we passed.
So Lively is not alone. No. And despite all this, and you wrote this, Marjorie, too, and I know people are not, I assume people are not going to say to you, by the way, I support him because he is this vicious anti-LGBTQ.
No, they didn't say that. They said it was about Donald Trump.
But there are a lot of people who signed a petition to put this repeal of the public accommodation law on the ballot.
Right.
I don't find that to be hugely different from some of the positions that Lively has taken. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that it wasn't on the merits of his position on these issues.
In any case,
we're talking to Sue O'Connell. So speaking about the mainstream, it's not just here. Oklahoma, what are they doing on adoption? And apparently they're not the only state that's doing this.
No, Oklahoma, again, we're kind of back to the 1990s here. They passed a bill on Friday that the Governor Mary Fallon signed that allows religious groups and private organizations who are acting as adoption agencies to use their own discretion whether or not they want LGBT parents to apply to be adoptive and foster parents within their organizations. We had the same thing happen here with Catholic Charities back in the early part of this century.
And they still haven't changed, have
they? What they did is they stopped doing adoptions. Right. They said rather than place children in need with
that's awful.
With certified, investigated, approved, social worker stamped LGBT parents, we would rather have the kids not placed anywhere, and they disbanded it. So this is one that is disturbing to child advocates who know that kids need homes regardless of the orientation of the parents. And this joins a number of other states.
Seven or eight other states
that are moving that. Again, this is part of that religious freedom viewpoint that you shouldn't have to force a religious organization to accept something they feel is against their religion, which I agree with in theory. But when you are placing children up for adoption, I think that puts you firmly into the social services world.
Well, you know, but my reaction, with all due respect, is those kids, they can be in foster care or whatever. I mean, that's a... I learned that from General Kelly.
Or they can go to military age detention.
Exactly.
Whatever.
That's our latest thing.
You know what's amazing? Not amazing. I want to play the role of Marjorie Egan now, if I can, when she's talking about how Republicans in Congress are on the wrong side of virtually every issue vis-a-vis where the public is, not vis-a-vis just your opinions, but polls. It is amazing to me. When I read this, I assumed Oklahoma, when I started reading the story in the New York Times, was, you know, one outlying state.
No.
And the governor is saying it has nothing to do with gays and lesbians at all, even though if you read the language, it's pretty
clear
that it does. They're moving these states in the exact opposite direction that the American people are. Mm-hmm. We talked to you. What didn't it? 60%, I think, was the number that was cracked for the first time in terms of same-sex marriage. Every single demographic supports it except conservative Republicans in the most recent poll. And I assume when most people say, I support same-sex families, they probably know that many families choose to have children. And so the assumption I make is that the American people are fine with loving couples, regardless of their gender, having kids, and eight states are deciding, let's ignore all that.
Right, and it's also flying in the face of all the research that's been done in the decades since openly gay people have chosen to become parents. It was one highly debunked, really bad junk science survey that had been out that the right wing had been using for a long time. But now we're, you know, some 25, 30 years in and finding incrementally that some lesbians are better parents than
two moms
in general. But we're no better and no worse. In the
broad
strokes. Are
we leaving gay guys out of this picture?
No, but I mean, there is actually a research study that shows that lesbians are just a little bit better.
You know what's really sad about this?
I'm not.
And shame on Kathy.
I'm a complete failure, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Well, I know your kid. You are far from a complete failure.
Anyway, shame on Catholic Charities for not fixing this, because, as you know, there's a shortage of foster families.
Well, then you have, like, the Massachusetts Adoption Resource Center that courts same-sex couples, gets people trained to become foster parents. I mean, I know at least in this case three gay male fathers who signed up for the foster care service, got the training, and a month later got a call. Hey, we have a baby.
Yeah, but you know what? They're not quite as good as the lesbians.
Let's just be clear here.
You know, speaking of,
better.
On a related note, did you read this op-ed that I loved in the New York Times? I think the title was "A Gender Fluid Senior Senior Prom." Did you read? You know, I also love the New York Times. This is not the most beautifully written piece. It was just
but
this
that's
incredibly
what was great
real.
About it.
I thought it was great.
The whole thing was just this beautiful. Tell people what kid wrote about.
Ara Halstead, who lives in Washington, and he had to move out of family home. You know, a gender fluid kid. I'm not sure which.
Explain what gender fluid means.
Well, you know, hasn't really settled on feeling if the gender expression is male or female. Mm. Doesn't want to be locked into something, but had to leave the family home because the parents are so awful. Ended up with a loving family taking care, and wanted to go to the prom. And apparently, in Olympia, Washington, you either have to wear a suit or a dress. Mm-hmm. You only have two options, which I think is ludicrous. But that's a whole other issue. And you know, talked to some friends, hadn't been to the prom, was a senior, and they talked to him saying, well, you should go, and you should be.
Because the original parents said, you can't go to the prom.
Well, they wouldn't even let him go out of the house practically. Right. They found out that at the time, he was a gay woman.
Right.
And said, you can't go to any dances at all.
And encouraged to go to maybe be in the court, you know, and that and got people donated a suit so he could go, and just finally went and owned the prom experience. I mean, and I'm both, you know, thrilled that this happened and the community was accepting and found a family that could support him. On the other hand, I'm still caught up on this you have to wear a dress or a suit business.
But by the way, if you have not read this, this is a beautiful small story. I mean, you know, and when all these big issues, when we debate them in grand terms, I don't think they mean anything to anybody. When you bring it down to the barbershop level, as Barbara Anderson from Citizens for Limited Taxation used to say to me, and she's right, when you put a human face on this one kid, and it is such a beautiful piece that I think everybody can. You don't have to be gender fluid.
No.
But it also really
shines a light on how this whole the term that he uses in the piece too, this gender normative thing, where things really do. I mean, I'm a firm believer that if everybody could just be, this sounds like I'm Marlo Thomas for a moment. If everybody could just be who they are,
be who
people
they are,
weren't judging
exactly.
about it, everybody would be a lot less like caught up on these things. Like if you could be a gay woman and wear a suit and not have to, if you didn't feel that you were transgender, you could just be that way without feeling you have to fit into these norms.
Now, speaking of people being who they are and people understanding who they are and understanding that maybe they should make some changes in who they are, but they just can't control themselves. I wondered why we had this story
today. I'm sorry, what are you talking about, Marjorie?
About the Stanford researcher examining how people perceive interruptions in conversation. Is there any particular reason you chose to talk about this, Sue O'Connell?
Well, you know, I read this story, and I thought of Jim, and the reason I thought is because it all makes perfect sense to me because I'm an interrupter too.
I know you. I was going to say that as soon as you're done.
As soon as you were done, I was done. You were going to say that. And I found this research fascinating because besides the obvious gender issues, back to gender issues,
right.
that men perceive women as interrupting more, and when they are interrupting, they're the B word or they're these things. But besides that stuff, which we're all acknowledging exists, there seems to be, according to this research, two groups of people. People like Jim and me who, when there's silence, we want to fill it. We want to get it in there.
They are called high-intensity speakers in this research.
And then people like Marjorie, who enjoys the silence and feels like if it's being filled, then we must be interrupting her.
Rude.
Right?
And those are called low. I don't even really think she is a low-intensity
no,
speaker.
<she isn't. laughs>
But, you know, the
she's
notion here is
that
this woman who's doing the is it out of Stanford, out of your?
Yes.
I love this, by the way. She's talking about you're either interruptive or you're cooperative in your speech. And as Sue just said, high-intensity speakers are not only okay with interruption, that's how they think and that's how I think sometimes talking
right
over
now.
Each other,
totally
exactly. And low-intensity speakers, as she talks about, and by the way, high-intensity people uncomfortable with science, et cetera, you're supposed to talk, think that low-intensity speakers think it is rude to interrupt and that people should participate in conversations one at a time. Now, I didn't read the underlying research. I just read the summary of the research in the Stanford whatever publication. The thing that I don't think she did address, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I mean this seriously, is the world is made up of both of those kinds of people. How are those of us who are interrupters, you and me, supposed to coexist with people who like more cooperative conversation?
They should just be quiet without listening to us, I think is what. I mean, this struck such a nerve at me. You know, Susan Ryan Vollmar, who I think you guys know, Susan once invited me to a thing at the LGBT history thing here in Boston to talk about the origins of 1 in 10, the radio show and the publication that
you
was
were
in
host
the Boston
of.
Phoenix that I was host of and the originator of the publication. And they were all writers, every single one except for me. Right? I'm not like a writer by trade. They were all writers.
It's good. She publishes two newspapers.
I'm not a writer,
she's not
though.
A writer. That's great.
And then after the session, Susan looked at me and said, "What the hell is wrong with you? You didn't let anyone else speak. You're totally manic. You're almost psychotic. What's wrong with you?"
Nice.
Right? And we're dear friends, so it was okay. And I drove home and I realized that nobody was saying anything. In my viewpoint, so I felt it was my job to carry the water, to carry the ball. So the next time I was on a panel where she was the moderator of it, she took me aside and she said, and she made a little finger motion. She said, "When I do this, that means it's okay for you to talk." So that's what we need, Jim. Just someone around to tell us when we can talk.
You feeling better about my behavior now or no? I'm a high-intensity speaker, according to Stanford research.
Many years ago, it stopped bothering me, Jim. It doesn't bother me. But, you know, I do get the thing about filling space because when you're on vacation, I'm on with somebody else, I will do the same thing. If there's dead space, I'll jump right in there because you don't want to have dead space on the radio, like you're looking for your papers, you can't find what you're doing or something like that.
It's not just about radio. It's about life.
It's about life.
Yeah.
High-intensity speech.
I guess, but when you're
in the
car, but when you're in the car driving someplace with a friend or your daughter. You don't have to be talking all the time, right? You have to.
Oh, yes, you do.
You do?
Yes, you do. All the time.
Okay,
Jim. I got
okay,
things to say,
you.
And you exactly. need to listen.
Time
you
is short.
You need to listen.
Sue, it's great to see
Good
you.
To
Thank
see you,
you
too.
As always.
Yes, absolutely. Sue O'Connell is co-publisher of Bay Windows in the South
Not
Bend
a writer,
News.
Though.
She's not a writer. Show me
her.
Get hand
Not
here.
Not a writer.
And a BPR contributor. Thank you very much, Sue O'Connell, for coming
see you,
in.
Sue.
Up next, yesterday we talked about how shock treatment is making a comeback for treating depression. Are psychedelic drugs making one, too? It's the subject of Michael Pollan's new book. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And with the omnivore's dilemma, Michael Pollan changed the way we thought about food. In his latest book, could he do the same for how we think about psychedelic drugs? It's entitled How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. The only thing left out of the title was sex and rock and roll. Maybe we'll get to that, too. Michael Pollan, it's great to see you again. Thanks
Good
so much
to be
for
back.
Being here.
Thanks.
It is great to see you, and congratulations on a fascinating
it
book.
It is fascinating.
But, you know, we think of you, Michael, we think of you as the food guy.
Yeah.
So how did you get from food to psilocybin, LSD, psychedelic drugs?
Well, mushrooms, you know, are in both camps.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
But my my interest in psychedelics is part of a longstanding interest I've had, actually, in our relationship to the natural world. I mean, that is my big subject. Food is an important part of that relationship. But another thing we use nature for, whether you're talking about plants or fungi, is to change consciousness. All of us today, I see a cup of coffee right there.
That's right.
Have used a plant to change consciousness. And I've always thought this is a very curious human desire. Why would we have this desire? Why would it be adaptive? And so that I've written about that a few times before in Botany of Desire and articles I've written on drugs. Psychedelics represents the most radical case of taking something from nature that changes your consciousness in dramatic ways. People have been doing it for thousands of years, and I got very interested in discovering why that might be.
But part of the genesis, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael Pollan, was you'd begun to hear that there was some usage in current times,
yes,
which is very beneficial for people with alcoholism or who were believed they were dying and those sorts of things. So
yeah,
there's a practical
Oh,
thing
yeah.
Here
no,
too.
The reason I decided to do it now was because I started reading about these studies going on at NYU and Johns Hopkins, very prestigious, you mm-hmm. know, medical centers, where they were using psilocybin to treat people who had cancer diagnoses, who were alcoholics, and they were really picking up on research that was done in the 50s. Before Timothy Leary and the backlash against psychedelics, and that they were getting very good results. And the idea that you would have a terminal cancer diagnosis and then you would go on a psychedelic seemed to me so weird and so not what I would do that I became curious to know how was this molecule actually helping in that situation.
So before we talk about the promise or potential promise, whatever you want to say, about psychedelics in 2018 and beyond, one of the parts I love about this book is the history. Because Margie and I
which
were
is local, which is very local.
I was just going to say, so much of it local. Everybody remembers, even if you're young, turn on, tune in, drop out, Timothy Leary,
yeah,
Harvard professor until he was no longer a Harvard professor. Give us, if you can, sort of the Cliff Notes version
sure.
of the rise and fall of psychedelics in our
yeah.
lives.
Sure. Well, the story goes back. I mean, for most Americans, they didn't tune in to psychedelics until Timothy Leary in the 60s.
You're talking
right?
to one.
But it was going on from 1950 or so. There was a very active program of research going on in Canada, in England, and in L.A., and in Vancouver, a couple other places. And they were getting some interesting results, and they were treating it as a new psychiatric intervention. LSD had recently been discovered, and psychiatrists and neuroscientists were trying to figure out, what is it good for? What does it teach us about the brain? How might we help people with it? 1960, a personality researcher named Timothy Leary, very well regarded, has an experience with magic mushrooms in poolside in Cuernavaca. He said he learned more in 4 hours on that trip than he had learned in his entire career as a psychologist, including graduate school. And he had just been hired by Harvard. And he gets back in the fall, and he goes to the chairman of his department and says, we got to study this. I want to start something called the Harvard Psilocybin Project. And he begins, and they give him approval. Remember, these drugs are all legal at the time. And he starts administering it to people in a naturalistic setting, which was essentially living rooms. And
graduate students, theoretically, not
that's
undergraduates.
That's right. He was limited. He could give the drug to graduate students, not to undergraduates. Mm. And he would do this in there. He was living in Newton in his house. And he kind of very quickly became so enchanted by these drugs, and he gradually switched from psilocybin to LSD, which is more powerful, that he lost interest in science. And he went from the idea that we could treat individuals with these drugs to the fact that we needed to treat the entire society. And we don't have a paradigm for treating a whole society, prescribing a drug to a whole society. But he really felt so strongly that it's silly to study this in a double-blind. You can't even really do a good double-blind study, although they tried at Marsh Chapel with a very famous experiment where they gave psilocybin to 20 divinity students in 1961 to see if they could see God. And 10 got the drug, 10 got a placebo. The 10 on the placebo sat in the pews like this, getting really annoyed at the 10 who were like, oh, my God. There he is.
There he is.
And they had this profound religious experience. I don't know what they proved exactly. So he did do some experiments, but over time he just became an evangelist for everybody should use this.
And ultimately, not too long later, as his profile rose, concerns rose, and no less than the President of the United States, yeah. Richard Nixon at the time, didn't the most dangerous man in America.
He called Timothy Leary, by then a washed-up psychology yeah. professor, who had been fired from Harvard, the most dangerous man in America, which is kind of astonishing. But a lot of people, Ronald Reagan believed this too, and Nixon believed that these drugs were really fueling the counterculture and sapping the will of American youth to fight in Vietnam. And in fact, Leary had said this. He said, kids who take LSD will not fight your wars. And so it was, the drugs did have a tremendous effect on the counterculture. They shaped its styles. I think they contributed to this generation gap, which was really unprecedented. You had young people creating their own culture, different way of dressing, different kind of music, different sexual mores, ethics. Everything was different. And this was terrifying to adults and certainly to the people in charge politically. It was the first time in history, I think, where we had a rite of passage that was not knitting culture together, but separating it. Because normally a rite of passage, whether you're talking about a bar mitzvah or a vision quest, is organized by the elders to bring the adolescents right. into adult society. Here, the kids had organized the rite of passage, and it landed them in a country of the mind that no adult knew anything about.
Well, talk about that country of the mind, Michael Pollan, that as you described so well, that people were having these mystical experiences, experiencing a oneness with nature or a oneness with God, whatever it was. And unlike usually if you have 17 cocktails and you think you're having a oneness with nature at 2 o'clock in the morning, the next morning you have a big hangover.
You feel silly about it.
These experiences stayed with people and with you, which we're going to talk about in a second, when they were sober.
Yeah, one of the real hallmarks of the kind of the psychedelic experience is it has a concreteness and a reality. Unlike dreams, unlike being drunk or on other drugs, you really believe what you saw is revealed truth, not some subjective experience. And that's a really strange thing about these drugs.
Yeah.
I have some theories why it should be. I mean, I think one of the things that happens under a high dose experience is your ego dissolves, essentially. And when your ego dissolves, there's no in and out. There's no subjective, objective. Everything is objective. And so the force, the conviction people leave these experiences with is powerful. And it can be very therapeutic. Because if you have some insight during a trip, like, geez, smoking, really not very good for me. You know, something really stupid and banal like that. If you have it during a psychedelic trip, it's like, oh, my God, the tablets. If this is true.
Yeah.
And you believe it in a way you never did before.
And you report some evidence that it can end one of the most difficult addictions.
Smoking.
A smoking addiction. So let's talk about you for a couple of seconds, not just your work. you were not a, is it fair to say, a major experimenter? We're roughly in the same age group, three of us, when you were a kid.
I did not have really any experience of psychedelics in college or high school.
Why was that? What was wrong with you?
Well, I came of age at a moment when the backlash was in full flower, and everything you heard about psychedelics was terrifying. LSD scrambled your genes. College kids would stare at the sun till they went blind. You know, people would take a trip and never come back.
Yeah.
And
peel off your skin. I remember reading that.
Yeah. Or the famous story of the guy who took so much orange sunshine for the rest of his life, he believed he was an orange. but most of these were not true. So I believed it all, and I was just terrified. And I didn't feel I was a sturdy enough person at that age to risk everything. And so this just wasn't part of my biography until I was nearing 60.
So when you started doing the research, was your original notion that in addition to tracing the history and the potential promise of psychedelics, that I will try them because that's what I have to do to be a responsible journalist, or did the trying them come later in the work?
No, I started writing about this. I wrote a long piece for The New Yorker.
2015?
Called The Trip Treatment, which is about giving the drugs to cancer patients at NYU and Johns Hopkins. And that was a very straight piece of science journalism. And while I was doing it, I was talking to people who were having these experiences that sounded so interesting, you know, that a single experience on a molecule could reset your thinking about death, that I just became really curious. What is that about? How can I really understand that experience without having it? So there was that. And I was talking to people who, I don't know, as you get to be our age, you sometimes can feel a little stuck in various grooves of thought and behavior that you wouldn't mind breaking out of. I mean, you know.
So were you nervous?
I was terrified.
And you had a guide, as you call it, correct?
Yes, I always work with a guide.
Yeah.
Not always. Most of the time I work with a guide. The night I did 6 or 7 trips. Uh-huh. I work with LSD, with psilocybin on 2 occasions, with ayahuasca on 2 occasions, and a very strange psychedelic called 5-MeO-DMT, which is the smoked venom of the Sonoran Desert Toad.
Is that for real?
For real.
The smoked venom
of the Sonoran Desert Toad.
Okay.
You can milk these toads.
Of course you can.
I mean, it's amazing that human ingenuity came up with that one.
So what was your first experience like?
So the first experience was an unguided trip on psilocybin and sort of in a more recreational sense, outdoors in my garden and in our house. And it was powerful. I had a very strong, you know, my interest, as I said at the beginning, is very much about nature. And I've always thought that we don't give plants enough credit for being aware of their environment and reacting appropriately. And plants became conscious. I was aware of them looking at me. I know this sounds really wanky. But I determined when I wrote this book I wasn't going to be embarrassed. I was just say what happened. And I had a sense of plant consciousness that I'd never had before. And
plant consciousness, that is so...
I know.
I'm with you completely.
Thank you, Marjorie.
I had to get rid of my poinsettia. I was devastated.
Okay, why don't you be transparent, since Michael Pollan is telling the truth about his life.
I think you could say that we were young and irresponsible once, and we may have investigated some of these things, but
I don't know how irresponsible. I mean, but yes.
Young and irresponsible?
We experimented.
I think most people would think it wasn't that responsible to try these different things. You didn't know
what was your first experience like?
I'm not going to get into my experience.
Why not?
Well, you tell
Michael
us
Pollan
yours.
Did.
Why don't you tell us yours?
Well, I was with my guide. This is. Let me do an OJ thing. If I did it, right. Which I did, actually, I was with my guide. His name was Joe Kaharick. I went to University of Pennsylvania, and all my friends at Penn who were contemplating doing LSD when we were kids, the guy we picked was Joe Kaharick, who did not go to the school, but I don't even know how he got there. But he was there and was a friend to all of
us. What qualified him to be a guide?
I have no idea. Well, I assume he'd done it a lot, and he had been the guide for a few of our friends, so people felt comfortable with him. And I know my experience was not unlike that which I've heard from a lot of other people. Joe administers hands me the LSD, I put it under my tongue, whatever, do the thing. And I keep saying to Joe what I thought was forever, it's not working. Obviously, it's not working. You know, Joe, you're great at what you're not. And then all of a sudden, oh, my God. And by the way, I'm not suggesting people should go out and do anything. You should make your own decisions. It was unlike anything I've ever experienced in my whole life. I don't know if I saw God. I don't know what I did. But I know that it was an otherworldly, life-changing kind of thing. It was unbelievable. And Marjorie may have had the same experience, but won't talk about it.
We're talking with Michael Pollan about how to change your
maybe
mind.
Maybe she will.
I want you to talk about the guy that was dying of cancer. And you talk about this in the book, that people are afraid of dying in many cases, and how his attitude changed after he tried some psychedelics.
So I spent a lot of time learning about a journalist who was my age named Patrick Metis. He was a news producer for MSNBC in New York, and he got bile duct cancer in his 50s, and it spread to his lungs, and he didn't have very long to live, and he was paralyzed by fear and anxiety. He heard about this trial going on at NYU. He got in, and he had a single, fairly high-dose psilocybin journey. And in this journey, he traveled through his life and met people who he had known in the past. He had an experience in the middle of the journey of kind of climbing up on this precipice, and it was all like stainless steel, and looking over it, and there was this field of consciousness that he realized was in his future. And that he could go there now if he wanted to, and that this was what his death would be like. He'd kind of get folded into this consciousness, but he wasn't ready to go. He loved his wife very much, Lisa, and he stepped back, and he realized, I have more to do here, but that's where I end up, and I'm okay with that when I get there. And many other things happened, but this was the key insight for him. And when that trip was over, he was he had this moment of ecstasy at the end, and his life was changed. He went on to live 17 more months. He spent that time, part of it he stayed on his chemo for a while, then he gave it up because the quality of his life he realized was more important than the quantity at this point. And he died with an equanimity that his wife described, that his psychologist described, that was quite remarkable. Everybody in the hospital, he was at Mount Sinai in New York, the staff gravitated toward his room because of this emanation of love he was putting out. And shortly before he died, his wife took a photograph of him, and she sent it to me. And when I popped this photograph open on my computer, it just took my breath away. This emaciated man, oxygen clip, hospital gown, beaming. 5 days before his death. I mean, it was uncanny, and that was one of the things that made me realize I had to see what this was about.
Well, you know what else I find fascinating? You mentioned William James and his Varieties of Religious Experience, which is a fascinating book, which is a lot about mysticism.
Oh yeah.
And you look at people that whether you're talking about Confucius or Buddha or Thomas Merton, there are all these people that would call themselves mystics. Who've meditated for a long time or prayed for a long time all through history. So it's very interesting because that's their equanimity, certainty of, or near certainty of faith. So it's very interesting how some people get there that way, and some people like Carlos Castaneda that we all read in college got there through mushrooms or other things. But it seems to be the same place.
Yeah,
and that you can't really talk about because people think you're nuts.
That's right. That's right. And also, there's this sense that a mystical experience achieved through prayer and meditation is the real thing, and if it's achieved through molecules, it's cheating.
Or it's a shortcut, perhaps.
And it is a shortcut, but it's the same experience. And probably the mystical experience is mediated by the same brain chemistry, however it is caused.
Yeah.
And that all our experience is mediated by brain chemistry. And so, you know, Houston Smith, the scholar of religion, who was part of the experiment going on here in the early 60s, you know, he said there is no distinction between the kind of mystical experience that Merton and people like that were describing and this experience which he had had. And but one of the things that happens when you've had a mystical experience on a psychedelic is you understand that literature, which I was blind to it. It was like it was so abstract. It made no sense unifying with the, you know, merging with the universe, all these things that seem so thin. You know, Emerson in The Common, you know, saying I was a transparent eyeball. The currents of reality were moving into my head. I thought that stuff was just like literary conceit. And then I had this experience. I was like, oh, that's what they were talking about. It's very hard to describe.
And you know what else I think is fascinating? You talk about, so people say, well, suppose this is all in your head.
Yeah.
And what was the answer you got to suppose this is all in your head?
Well, I mean, I asked the doctors. They said, you know, is this just an illusion you're giving people of immortality or that there's something after death? And they said one of a couple things. Some doctors said, who cares? If it helps people die, who cares? And others said, hey, we don't really know what happens after we die. This is above my pay grade. So I couldn't really get a straight answer on that. But there, of course, there is no answer on that.
Michael Pollan, before you go, we've talked about potentially helping deal with smoking, with dealing with alcoholism, coping with death and beyond coping.
Oh, yeah, Bill Wilson, the guy that started Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. He thought he had a mystical experience on belladonna.
Well, he did have a mystical experience that got him sober.
Yeah.
And later in his career thought he had worked with LSD. The psychiatrists in UCLA were giving him LSD. And he realized this could really help people get sober. And he tried to introduce it to AA. And the board was like, this kind of muddies our brand.
I'm sorry.
Speaking of muddy, no, it's fine. Muddies our brand. My guess is your goal was to crack some minds open for those who remember the worst of the Timothy Leary moment and the disgrace that this all fell into for those who admitted they were using psychedelic drugs. Is the world ready to have their mind cracked open?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to find that out in the next couple of weeks.
What are you finding?
So far, I've been out talking about this and doing a lot of media, and I get the sense, I just did a call-in show on Point, that people are ready to have another kind of conversation about this. That all the 60s baggage that covers these drugs, we might be ready to let it go. And when we are, we can just have a new kind of conversation where we look at them as potential tools and we study them scientifically and we share our experiences openly. I'm really encouraging people to come out of the closet because so many people have a very important personal experience that they put in this box called weird drug experience and they don't take it out. I think for some people, I'm kind of the occasion to take it out and think about it. And these are not just drug experiences. These are real psychological facts in your biography, and they're worth thinking about and worth learning from.
Michael, it's great to see you.
What do you think,
always.
Jim? You want to go for it again?
I'll talk to Michael after the show. Thank you, Marjorie. Enough is enough in terms of disclosure here. Great to see you.
Thank you, guys.
And Michael Pollan is a professor of journalism at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. His latest book is How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence.
You know, we were just talking a minute ago. Let's continue with callers
to
get their reaction to what Michael had to say.
And Jim can tell you a few more
stories
about
this. No, I'm not telling you. I actually am telling you nothing more. So we're going to continue the conversation with you at 877-301-8970. What's your reaction to what you heard from Michael Pollan? If you want to share your own experiences, good and bad, we'd be happy to hear them. Give us a buzz. Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Just heard our conversation with Michael Pollan, who has food fame, but I think another thing is about to be added to his resume. The name of his new book is How to Change Your Mind. What's the subtitle, Marjorie, under How to Change Your Mind?
What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And, you know, the story he told about the most compelling part of this for me is the transformative work he's seen with people who are dying.
Oh,
because a lot of people are in a total panic. You know, they're afraid of dying. What's this going to mean? And if you can have, and as he said, if it's not real, so what? If you can have a more tranquil, peaceful death.
How about the guy you described, the one you
exactly.
asked about?
I mean, it's a wonderful thing. So, you know, I'm big on legalizing drugs. I think it'll be wonderful if people have these opportunities.
So we want to talk about your reaction to what you heard Michael say. It's relatively radical. You haven't heard many people talking in recent years about psychedelics making a comeback, particularly making a comeback to deal with alcoholism or a smoking addiction or fear of dying and that sort of thing. Give us a buzz. If you want to talk about your own experiences or lack of them, that's fine at 877-301-8970. And how do you feel about the promise as described by Michael a couple of minutes ago in some areas that are pretty important parts of life? You know, the thing that you asked him about at the end, where one of the doctors said to him, who cares as long as
it
works?
Well, you hear people say that about faith.
Yeah.
You know, they say you spend your whole life, you know, you're praying away here. Suppose this is all a bunch of bunk and you've imagined it. And the person says, well,
Works for me.
Works for me, and I've had a more joyful life because of it. So what?
You know, you and Michael, we'll get to your calls in about 30 seconds. You and Michael were talking about religion and faith, and that's what I forgot to bring. I meant to, and I forgot about it. Part of the history that he tells of psychedelics is somebody who is, I can't remember the guy's name, who is a central figure in this, talking about the use of psychedelics going back so far, potentially thousands of years, that his conjecture, admit that he can't prove it, is belief in God may have originated in this one researcher's opinion in psychedelics. And that is it essentially trickled down or trickled up from that experience a couple of thousand years ago. So in any case, 877-301-8970, where do you want to go?
Let's start with Trish in Newburyport. Hi, Trish.
Hi, Trish. Thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's wonderful. You know, it will help. I think we're in a time that the stigma has to be, you know, removed from some of this. And I was saying when I called in initially that, I mean, I experienced some of this just through meditation. And so if this can be a stepping stone for people to start to expand, that it's going to open perceptions and just not only the hearts. I mean, it's really not using the mind. It's using from the soul and the heart. And that's what it's opening up.
Well, you're a mindfulness person, Marjorie. Do you buy what Trish
is
saying there?
I'm a meditator, Trish, and I think lots of people feel as though that's what they're part of the attraction of meditation is altering your consciousness, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
yeah.
I mean, I can tell you, the more I've meditated, it's almost like the veil starts to drop the deeper and deeper you go. And it's pretty profound what you can experience. And it becomes hard. I say we're in a time where a bridge is needing to be built between the layman and what has been known as mysticism. And it's almost that once that build is bridged, we can really start to look at this as something new, that it's no longer, the stigmas are removed and it's no longer so magical and mystical, that this is truly just what we are in and beginning to discover as in humanity.
Well, I'll tell you, if anybody can remove the stigma from something, it's Michael Pollan, because of the respect that people in the general public and academics have for him. I think he has potential to crack a lot of heads up, minds open. Trish, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, you know, I think when you think about people, that's why I always mention Martin Luther King. If you think of mysticism as an experience of the transcendent, mm-hmm. or an experience of God, I always mention Martin Luther King because people don't think of him as some person that's been in an ashram for 60 mm-hmm. years, you know, meditating or chanting or something. He was obviously a civil rights leader. You could certainly say he was a mystic because he talked about hearing the voice of God telling him, I'll be with you always. And people don't like to talk about that because it makes you sound like a nut. But there are a lot of people that would probably not call themselves mystics but have had mystical experiences.
But there's a non-mystical side to this, too. I mean, when we talked about alcoholism and cigarette addiction to cigarettes kind of thing. I mean, yesterday we were talking about ECT, the 60 Minutes
right.
piece, a radical treatment in the minds of some that obviously has been a huge help to Kitty Dukakis and thousands like her. If something like this gives hope, obviously under appropriate supervision, to people who can't deal with any of the crises we were talking about, I mean, my attitude is bring it on.
Of course, we should point out that Whitey Bulger was in the LSD study.
Oh, that is true. That is true.
Was it Alcatraz at that point?
I don't think that anyone's suggesting.
It didn't seem to help him very much.
Well, I think it was a little late in the game. Well,
endeavors.
That's probably true. 877-301-8970. You know what the other plus out of this is?
What?
That we were half joking before. When Michael Pollan is willing to admit, not willing to admit, does admit that he tried it and what his experiences were, it's going to cause a lot of other people, two of them being right here, who wouldn't talk about this otherwise, to feel like you have permission to talk about it, not be damned. But you know what I mean? Or
yeah,
no.
Well, I think lots of people that were in college in the 70s and maybe 80s. Well, maybe 80s, I guess, was when cocaine came in and that sort of changed everything. But during the 70s, the magic mushrooms were big and psilocybin was big. And I did a few things here and
you
there.
You did? Like
yeah.
what? Like what? Why aren't you looking at me
yeah, I
anymore?
I did a few of those things.
Marjorie, stop
because
looking
I'm on
at
the
me.
Radio.
That's the end of the
Christy
conversation.
In
oh,
Brighton.
My kids may be listening, she's saying.
Hi, Christy.
Hi, Christy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for choosing me. I want to thank your producer. She got my name wrong the first time, but she was interested in what I said. I spent over 3 years in Peru. I wrote a novel there. I haven't even typed yet. Friends of mine founded Casa Chacruna in Iquitos, which is like a world center for ayahuasca tourism. I mean, you can pay anywhere from $40 a day for a mosquito-infested jungle with a genuine Shipibo shaman, ancient tradition, never learned Spanish, your daughter translates. You can pay $160 a day for a place that's, you know, air-conditioned cabin with people doing your laundry as soon as you drop it on the floor. The part about Peru that fascinates me, and I want to write about it, maybe for High Times if they'll print it when I get back, is the legal system is changing rapidly, okay? It's really weird that cannabis is still a serious crime, although people smoke it on the sidewalk outside the police station.
Christy, I hate to interrupt you, but tell us, are you talking about what we're talking about here, the drugs and mindfulness or mysticism or cures for depression? Where are you going with this?
The Shipibo tradition is the purpose of ayahuasca traditionally in rainforests is to contact the spirit world.
Oh, okay.
Which is why I don't think people who use ayahuasca in the United States, the religious tradition is genuine. It's from Brazil, but the rainforest spirits, they don't leave home.
We got it. We got to go, Christy. Thank you for sharing your Peruvian experience with us. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Upton, where Allison is on the phone. Allison, welcome. Thanks for your call. Hi.
Hey, guys. Hi.
Hi.
I think that psychedelics are a crucial part of any mystical or spiritual or any human experience on this planet. I think it's really important to experience the other side, or like the other caller described, as behind the veil. I meditate as well, but it's not the same as when I do psilocybin. And the key for me, and Michael Pollan touched on it as well, the key for me is when you get to the level of dissolving your ego and you're just a being, you're just energy at that point, that's really where the oneness comes through the door. And when that oneness comes through the door, like Timothy Leary said, if you dose these kids, they're not going to fight your war, man. And it's true. It's true. You can experience no ego and that oneness with everyone and go out with an Uzi and kill babies. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, well,
I think it's crucial.
That's what he talks about in the book, Allison. You really enjoy it. He talks about that sense of everything is one. You know, the nature, the earth, the sky, the people, the whole kind of
thing. Did you experience that?
I think you do on those things.
You do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
Allison,
in a different circumstance.
I was in a different circumstance.
Yeah.
I was not exactly a mystical kind of guy in those days, or now, actually.
Of course, I went to an actual class in college called Altered States of Consciousness.
You know, when you say
yes,
that, is that
I
really
did.
True?
Absolutely.
That
I went
was
to college
at Stanford?
In California. He was at UC Berkeley. That was like a half hour
Michael,
away from me, so no wonder he had these same kind of
altered
things going on.
States
altered
of
States
consciousness
of Consciousness. My father really loved that. When
I
he
bet
saw
you.
It
was How much am I paying for that one?
Exactly.
Exactly.
Callie from Middletown.
Hi,
Callie. Hi,
Callie. Welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
We're very well. Thank you for calling. What's up?
I apologize. But I caught you at the end. And what's fascinating to me is, you know, I'm a yang person. I'm not a yin person. I don't meditate. I don't do drugs. I've never been interested. But my question is, so many of these mystics over history have come about the revelation, the mystical state, the oneness experience with God, whatever you call it, by way of some form of physiological deprivation, whether it's not eating for days, whether it's sleep deprivation.
Kelly, you're going in and out, so you should just get to your question.
Okay.
I don't mean that disrespectfully. We just can't hear you that well. So tell us what you're posing.
So I'm saying how much of the state is based on physiological deprivation, which can come about in some other vehicle by way of sleep deprivation, fasting for days. Like what
I surely do not have the expertise to answer the question. Do you, Marjorie, or no?
No, I don't. But I know that a lot of people have... He mentioned the William James book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. That was talking about a lot of people's mystical experiences. Or Evelyn Underhill wrote a whole book about it, talking about people's experiences of mystical experiences. I don't know that the people in there were deprived of food, though.
Prior to Pollan's book, had you heard anything in recent times about psychedelics being used to...
Nope.
Address any of the conditions that
nope.
he's not a word, right?
Nope.
Nor had
I. But I remember reading about it at the time. If you weren't reading about how you're going to peel your skin off and think you were an orange, you were reading
orange
about
for
how,
life, he said.
Yeah, you were going to have a spiritual experience of oneness. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the big thing. So there were these two competing, and the question is whether you were going to be, you know.
No, but I'm talking about the practical application of psychedelics.
No,
that to me is the most important thing that he's writing about. Paul, you're in Halifax. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. How's it going?
Very well.
Fine,
thank
thanks.
You. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to call in because this conversation, you know, it's something that means a lot to me. Personally, I dabble in psychedelics every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
And just one night, it was late. I was still in the middle of my trip, and I just started deconstructing the ridiculousness of my smoking habit, smoking cigarettes. And as I was going through the process of deconstructing the whole absurdity of this notion of slowly killing myself, I kind of just had this epiphany where I was like, this is so absurd that I need to just stop doing it. And I took my pack of cigarettes, which was almost full. I crushed it in my fist quite triumphantly. And then I threw it in the trash. And since that day, I have not bought a pack of cigarettes.
Wow.
Well, that's exactly, yeah. I mean, Michael writes about that actually in the book. That is an amazing, amazing experience. Paul, and by the way, when Paul said thinking of killing him, he meant... By smoking cigarettes
right,
is
right.
what he was referencing. Paul, thank you for sharing that story. We appreciate it.
Well, I mentioned when Michael was here that Bill Wilson, who founded, co-founded,
AA.
I guess, AA, you know, he said he had this mystical experience on something
I didn't
called
know that
belladonna.
Either.
And he said that, and Michael says in the book, that few members of AA realize the whole idea of spiritual lake awakening, leading one to surrender to a higher power, which is one of the 12
mm-hmm.
steps, can be traced to Bill Wilson's psychedelic
is that
psychedelic
amazing?
Drug
did you ever know
trip?
That?
No,
I did not.
I did not know that. Bernie in Stoughton. Hi, Bernie.
Hello, Bernie.
Hi. I would relate an experience. I'm over 80 years old now.
Oh.
But back in the 80s, I went to a program called the Yes Training. Was
oh, yeah.
Werner Erhard, right?
Werner Erhard, exactly.
Sure.
And I was sitting in the program, and I had this experience being guided by the leader of the particular day I was there, mm-hmm. Imagining that your body was filling up with like orange juice or something warm and comfortable, and,
yeah.
and experiencing that all the way down from the top of my head, down through my limbs, down to my toes, and then turning on the faucet and letting it all drain out. And all of this was kind of a mystical experience going through it. Now, there were no drugs involved whatsoever, but it was all done with a recommendation from a leader.
Yeah.
Now,
what did that do for you,
driving,
Bernie? We're a little short on time. What did the orange juice experience do for you?
As I was driving home, I heard this item on the radio about every puff of cigarettes kills capillaries in your body.
Yeah.
And I said, that's insane. And I stopped smoking immediately. I had been smoking for over 20 years.
Wow.
And I stopped smoking, and I never felt an urge to have a cigarette again.
There you go. Two
That's
smokers.
That's the Est orange juice cure,
Bernie,
I believe.
Thank you very much for the call. That's right. The Werner Erhard. Remember that?
Werner Erhard.
You're supposed to look at a strawberry for like 45 minutes.
And you're not supposed. You're supposed to do a lot of self-deprivation kind of thing,
yeah,
too. You can't
there's
go
a lot
to the
of
bathroom,
self-deprivation there. I always was a little suspicious
what's
of that,
the name of the guy nickname of the guy in Brookline who's apparently the genius?
Oh,
of,
the Russian
hypnotist. Or whatever he
I don't
is.
Know. I don't know if he's still around. A lot of people want him to quit smoking. Anyway, that
do you ever think we'd be discussing psychedelics like this for 40 minutes?
Our psilocybin magic mushrooms segment.
Read the book. It's
comes
great.
To an end. It is. It's a fascinating book. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Chuck Todd is going to be with us. Andrew Cabral and our concert roundtable.
What are your favorite
really
things?
Fun.
I know you
yeah.
love it.
Thank our crew: Chelsea Murrows, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tereski, Molly Boygon, Christina Bieni. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our on-site engineer is Dave Goldstein. Special thanks for all the great food to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe. What is on television tonight, please, Jim?
Well,
Bradley.
Talk about good timing. Barack Obama's ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, is going to join me. He's got a new book out. But the reason I mentioned timing is obviously the Senate Judiciary released those transcripts today about Trump Jr.'s testimony about the infamous Trump Tower meeting with the Kremlin-connected lawyer. So that's pretty good timing. Bob Rivers is the CEO of Eastern Bank. On his board is communications specialist and diversity activist we all know, Colette Phillips. They're about to open a branch in Roxbury. We're going to talk about why that matters beyond just for Eastern Bank. And we're out of time, so I'll tell you there are other good things on the show tonight. It's at 7 o'clock on Channel 2.
Starring Jim Browdy, of course.
It's not starring. I am the host. There's no star. I'm the host of Greater Boston. It's not mine.
Okay.
I just temporarily am the host of
I'm
the
Marjorie
show.
Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.